This morning of the House Ag Policy Committee to order. We don't have enough members for a quorum yet, but we'll get started. It's going to be a busy agenda. We hope to move things along and get the entire agenda covered today. So again, welcome
this is the Backer Committee.
Members and guests and testifiers. And first up this morning will be House File Number 3441 with Representative Backer. Representative, the clock is ticking here. House File 3431, Representative Backer. Would you care to move your bill?
Yes, I would like to move the bill, Chair. And then we also have two amendments. But we got to wait for a quorum for that.
That's right. And I think I misspoke. House File 3441, my apologies for that.
That's what I heard.
So you want to briefly explain your bill, and we'll do the amendments when we get a quorum, okay?
Yes. Okay, members, Chair, and members, you know, what this bill really focuses on, to keep it really simple, is really telling the MPCA to follow federal standards in regards with what they would call bulk ag commodity rule, BACR. I've talked to quite a few producers in that area. Actually, this morning on the way in, I was talking to a producer, and he brought up a very good point. We're talking about biodegradable dust, but then because of their interpretation, wrong interpretation in my opinion, and we'll have testifiers to say the same, is that then we have trucks can be sitting up for 2 hours emitting, you know, CO2 and so forth. So it just doesn't make sense. The BAR is the old state rule that was written in 1976. Several businesses have built temporary storages since then. And now the MPCA has changed their interpretation, saying that BACR applies to temporary storage facilities. If so, the temporary storage facilities cannot meet the regulations. And again, members, we're talking about dust from corn. We're not talking about any deadly fumes or so forth. So it just doesn't make sense, and that's why I'm proud to carry this bill. What this bill does, it allows us to compile with the federal level, and that's what we're asking to do. So with that, I'll turn over to our testifiers.
Before we do that, we do have a quorum this morning, so I'll call a meeting to order officially, and let's take care of the minutes first. Representative Miller, would you approve the minutes, hopefully, of the March 14th meeting?
Mr. Chair, I studied these minutes. They're fantastic, and I ask that we move for their approval.
I knew that you would have. All those in favor of the March 14th minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passed, I think. Thank you. So, Representative Backer, let's take care of your amendments also first, okay?
Yes, let's do that, please.
And move your bill.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You know, I have it right here. Well, I thought I had it with me, but I move that we move House File 3441.
Very good. And you have two amendments. Members have those, the A07 and the A1. Would you care to explain those, please?
If we could move them together, and we'll explain them all at one, if that's okay, Chair.
Maybe we should take the first one first, because that's going to be your author's amendment on your A07. Explain what you're going to add to that one, Representative.
Okay, well, that one is it changes the definition. Well, what it does is it clarifies in 1.5 what a temporary storage facility means. And then we also clarify in 1.11, because what the facilities that we're talking about is corn bunkers that are next to a grain facility or ethanol plant. So then we're also clarifying portable equipment, what that means. And so that's why we need to get this into the form of the original bill.
Mr. Sullivan, any other addition to that?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, there's a very small change required on the BE-A07 amendment. Currently, the House file number is blank on line one. So an amendment that the author could incorporate into his amendment to fix that would be page one, line one of the BE-A07. Delete the ellipsis and insert 3441.
Thanks, Mr. Sullivan. Questions on that? members okay with it? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A07 is approved. Now, Mr. Representative Backer, to your A1 amendment.
Our A1, we just delete the on 1-2, so page 1, line 10, we delete uses and insert use. Just a catch-on grammatical error.
All in favor of the A1 amendment, again, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment's approved, and your bill is approved or introduced as amended. And now to your testifiers, Vice Chair.
Go ahead. I'll turn it over to Mr. Miller here.
Good morning, members of the committee. Chairman Anderson, thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning. I am Mick Miller, general manager of an ethanol plant in west central Minnesota called Denco 2 in Morris. We've been in operation at this facility for about 19 years, and we grind about 10 million bushels of corn per year. One of the things the state is dealing with is a large influx of grain during harvest. In the last 10 years, our state has seen an increase in corn bushels, our yield, increased by 20 bushels per acre. So as our farmers are becoming more and more efficient and with hybrids and whatnot, we've seen increasing trends, which is great for the agricultural community. But in the mid-2000s, it became very apparent that this large surge of grain needed a home, and what was incorporated was these temporary or flat storage facilities. We built a flat storage facility in 2005 and 6, and since then have operated that depending on grain movements. They're truly temporary. We have not filled it every year. They're only used for a few weeks out of the year, but it's an opportunity for large amounts of grain to move during the harvest season. Currently, we have built, constructed, paid for, and utilized this facility, and it's been permitted through the MPCA through their guidance in the past. Recently, in the 2015-2016 timeframe, we've been approached by the PCA basically saying that we're not in compliance with utilizing this flat grain storage facility. And my understanding is that they've changed their interpretation. What we've learned is that the federal EPA has guidance on these flat storage facilities or temporary storage facilities. And when using portable equipment, they're truly deemed as temporary because we may or may not fill them in the fall, depending on harvest conditions, how slow harvest is, how quick harvest is, and the yields, drought weather, you name it. So we are in compliance at the federal level, but my understanding is that the PCA is saying that we're not in compliance utilizing this flat storage facility. And all we're looking for is to become level the playing field. Right now, if you look at area states, bordering states, Iowa, South Dakota, North Dakota, Illinois, all of these other states are not subject to this state-written rule, this bulk egg commodity rule, which was written in 1976. It's 42 years old, was never enforced, and now with a change in interpretation, it looks that we're not able to utilize these, or there's very, very restrictive guidelines in order to utilize it. And our analysis is that in order to meet this state rule, we virtually cannot use this flat storage facility. So we are at a huge disadvantage compared to other states, and it just doesn't seem fair when we look at what's happening in today's environment with virtually upon us a farm crisis with commodity prices. If we were to not utilize this flat storage facility, and ultimately the entire state not utilize these, we're talking about somewhere in the neighborhood, these are assumptions, about 150 million bushels of corn not having a home or a spot or a surge an area to go during harvest. We grew 1.5 billion bushels of corn in the state last year, roughly 10% of it probably being stored in these temporary storage facilities. So if that grain doesn't have a home, that means that area elevators, processing facilities such as ours, our existing storage fills up very quickly. And when grain can't move, the basis widens out, and it can widen out quickly. And we see that happening during big harvest seasons. Farmers know that when there's a lot of grain in the area and a lot of grain moving, storage facilities fill up and the basis widens out. That means less income to our farming families when they need to move grain. We do not have enough infrastructure through traditional upright storage bins in the state, whether that be on the farm or at a processing facility. So if for whatever reason Denco 2 or ultimately the rest of the folks in the state that are utilizing these flat storage facilities are not able to use them, we're talking about a serious impact, millions of dollars of impact on lost revenue going to our farmers during the harvest season when grain typically moves.
Thanks, Mr. Miller. And I have a question from Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a few really quick, really short answered questions. So, Mr. Miller, thank you for being here today and testifying. How many people do you employ in your business?
Members of the committee, we employ 35 full-time employees and roughly three part-time employees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative, go ahead.
And how many farmers are served by your business?
Members of the committee, we currently purchase grain from area farms, about 450 farming families. Our business is built on direct farmer-producer relationships. We do not rely on purchasing grain from the commercial elevators. Reason being, corn off the farm is of better quality because it's handled less, and we have an opportunity to pay our area farmers more because it's not going to a commercial elevator, thus the elevator being the middleman, if you will.
Mr. Chair, one more question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Miller, have you received personally any complaints? Has Morris received any complaints? Or, to your knowledge, has the PCA received any complaints for the operations of your business?
Mr. Miller?
Representative Miller, members of the committee, my understanding is no. We've asked the MPCA if there's ever been any formal written verbal complaints on grain dust in our area, and the answer has been no. We also have our city administrator with us today in the audience that we've asked that same question to, and the answer has been no.
Mr. Chair, one more real quick question.
Go ahead, Representative.
Mr. Miller, to your knowledge, has there been any science that's been given to you by the PCA as to how this is dangerous to the community or area? Have they provided any of that information to you?
Mr. Miller.
Science-based.
Representative Miller, members of the committee, you're getting a little technical on me with that question. We do have Paul Madorsky with us today that is an environmental consultant that works for us that may be better suited to answer that question.
I can wait.
Mr. Madorsky, would you care to comment on that? Identify yourself and begin your testimony. Question was having to do with the scientific evidence for this rule by MPCA. Go ahead, sir.
Members of the committee, my name is Paul Madorsky. I'm with Mergent. I'm a senior analyst, environmental consultant, working with Denco 2 for doing their environmental permitting work. We have not gotten any specific scientific evidence. We do air dispersion modeling, which is used to support or demonstrate compliance with national ambient air quality standards, which are the basis for determining whether we can approve the pile.
Thank you.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions were answered with the...
Oh, okay. Very good. Thank you. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to, thank the author for this legislation because I have a facility in my district as well, affected just as the same as the Morris facility. It's a common sense kind of a piece of legislation that's more needed around here than less. So, again, I'm full-heartedly in support.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? And I would just add that this facility is not located on Main Street in downtown Morris. It's pretty much on the edge of town. Is that correct, Mr. Miller?
Chairman Anderson, yes, that is correct.
Anybody in the audience who would care to testify? I also have Bob Zelenka on the agenda. Good morning, sir. Identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Zelenka. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. Our association represents the grain elevator and feed mill industry in the state. We employ over 8,000 people in 450 locations around Minnesota. We also do employ the use of temporary storage bunkers. I agree with what was said previously. We do support the legislation. It is temporary. It's without temporary storage, we'd be hard-pressed to handle the commodities that we have right now. In Minnesota, there's approximately 600 million bushels of fixed storage and 2.5 million bushels of on-farm storage. It still is inadequate to handle the crop that we've had the last couple of years. So without temporary storage, it'd make it very difficult to operate. In terms of the I would just agree with what was said previously. I do have a letter that I have dated July 2014 from the Environmental Protection Agency that clearly states that temporary storage facilities do not meet the definition of permanent storage capacity under subpart DD and should not be included when determining applicability under subpart DD for the particular facility. This was a particular facility that was being looked at where they were lumping in temporary storage with permanent storage. So it's clear to me that EPA made it very clear, and I would think the state should follow suit in terms of realizing that temporary storages should be dealt with differently.
Thank you, Mr. Zelenka.
Any questions?
Questions from members? Representative Poppy.
I have a question. It's not necessarily directed to Mr. Zelenka, though.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, Representative.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just my question is in the bill on line 1.8, where it just talks about fugitive emissions standards. Can you just describe what exactly fugitive emissions are and how, and if that's a, obviously a term that's useful here? Thank you.
Mr. Mordosky?
Yes, members of the committee. The fugitive emissions are basically anything that's either uncaptured or uncapturable. So in the sense of portable equipment, it's emissions that can't be captured and sent out a stack or a vent.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is there a time limit for a fugitive emission? So if it's uncapturable, it's gone, is there a time that it dissipates at some point, or how kind of what's the length of time for that?
Mr. Mordosky?
Members of the committee, I don't believe that I can think of any time limit to it. It's really tied to the emission generating activity in terms of when it's generated, and then in terms of dissipating, it's always going to be site specific, but obviously with distance, dust will dissipate to lower and lower concentrations.
One more follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think just one more. Is there a condensation number? I mean, is there a so that emissions that are uncapturable is a large cloud of it versus just kind of it kind of slowly dissipates into the atmosphere? Is there, I'm just, I think this is an interesting proposal to talk about and to try to figure out how to help solve the problem here. I'm just trying to think, is there any way to kind of put borders around how much can be, and if that leads to a greater problem, if I'm making myself at all clear.
Mr. Mordosky, you want to try to handle that one?
Committee members, yeah, I believe that the I think what it sounds like is we're wondering if there is a threshold at which emissions are truly fugitive and not capturable.
Thank you, yes.
From this type of equipment. And I think the challenge with the portable equipment is, it's portable in its nature. So when it comes to the fugitive emissions, you would, in essence, have to remove the portable nature of the equipment in order to not have the fugitive emissions. That makes sense. It's basically the idea is you can't enclose a portable equipment unless you make it stationary so it doesn't move, because the enclosure would have to move with it.
Okay. Again, if I may add, I think we're talking about unloading trucks into an auger, which augers it up to a pile. And this horizontal storage then is piled in outside storage and difficult to capture. Mr. Miller, I had a quick question. Does this rule, in effect, shut down temporary storage or curtail the use of storage?
Members of the committee, Chairman Anderson, based on our working and negotiations with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, I'm at the understanding that we can't meet compliance based on the bulk aid commodity rule. Thus, we would not be able to utilize it. I'm familiar with experiences at other facilities similar to ours that have looked at building these recently and have decided to not do it. I think just for the fact of not getting into a wrestling match, if you will, with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. This is kind of getting into time is of the essence. We personally are working on renewing our air permit. We've been working on it for more than 2 years. Still do not have our renewed air permit, and this is one of the things that's holding it up. And might I add that if you look at the total emissions or from the facility, dust particles, particulate matter, this is just a couple percent of our total emissions on our entire ethanol production facility. And as a reminder, it's only for a few weeks out of the year at best, and in some years we don't utilize it. So we're trying to get back to, you know, it's temporary, it's portable, it's used to handle the surge of grain should it need be to be utilized during the harvest season.
Thank you. In fairness, I think we have MPCA here, but I would just say if we're talking about curtailing or stopping the use of the outside storage, this is extremely serious. Farmers need to be able to dump their grain harvest time in the fall in a quick and timely fashion, and this is serious if this is taking place. So any other further comments from members or testifiers? If not, I MPCA is here. I'm looking forward to hearing from them, and we'll call them up right now. Good morning, gentlemen. Identify yourselves and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Pollution Control Agency, and today I'm joined with our by.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Jeff Smith. I'm the Director of the Industrial Division at the MPCA.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first I'd like to say that I think we have a fundamental disagreement with the people who have been speaking before and with the author, unfortunately. We oppose this bill as it's currently written. We disagree that we have changed our approach to applying this regulation, and we disagree that we are misinterpreting federal law. We think that this legislation would be in significant conflict with federal law. The law does not allow significant emission sources to be exempted. The bill may give the owner and or operator of a temporary grain storage facility the mistaken impression that emission standards do not apply, but they will because they are federal law. Issuing permits without consideration of these emission sources puts us and the permittee in conflict with the federal law and subjects us all to possible EPA overfiling and the taking of enforcement action, and it opens the permittee to citizens' lawsuits. It's unfair to facilities who are already complying with these emissions, and it should be understood that these are not insignificant emission sources, as we typically receive over 20 complaints each year regarding these types of activities. We're certainly willing to work with the author to try to address our concerns, but we can't support the bill as it's currently written.
Mr. Thornton, EPA, of course, is federal, national, and as I understand, this is not an issue in neighboring states, Iowa, South Dakota, Wisconsin. Could you comment on that, please? Or Mr. Smith?
Mr. Chair, members, it is an issue in other states. The release of emissions from these storage piles, in fact, that have been cited by other states, and other states do take enforcement action on a regular basis. I think the proposal, the message you heard today about this being okay with EPA, we actually have letters from other states like Nebraska, who specifically, when this measure was proposed by EPA in 2014, there were specific responses by many of the Midwestern states, agricultural states, to say, do not do this. This is a problem in terms of emissions at our farming communities with flat storage. Because of that, EPA did not promulgate that rule, and that's why it's not a federal standard. It was envisioned and thought about by EPA, but they did not make that into a federal regulation.
So you're saying this 2014 proposed rule was never promulgated?
That's correct, Mr.
So what are you working under, working off?
We're just working through our normal process of looking at larger facilities. BACR, the bulk egg commodity rule, applies to larger facilities that meet certain thresholds. So it doesn't apply to every facility. We apply it to the larger facilities in the state, and right now there's only a handful of those that are subject to BACR. I think it's more important to understand that we are really trying to solve this problem versus trying to focus on what the regulations say. Our goal is to make sure that when emissions are happening, when loading and unloading of the flat storage facilities are happening, that facilities are doing everything they can to minimize the release of fugitive emissions. That has been our overall goal. We're trying to take a very reasonable approach to this. So that has been our, we don't want to have emissions leaving the property boundary. That is the point where noncompliance occurs. So that's been our focus versus focusing on the BACR rule as a specific measure.
And Mr. Smith, when you talk about the fugitive emissions, what exactly are we talking about?
Mr. Chair, fugitive emissions result from the loading and unloading of the flat storage facility or other activities like trucks driving on gravel roads. Those are also considered fugitive emissions. These are things, and you can usually see fugitive emissions. They're clouds of dust or grain particles or things like that that are visible, that when they're leaving the property boundary, that's the compliance point, and that's the point that we are looking at those to say it is or is not a problem.
And again, I would just say, all of us trying to use common sense, has this been a problem?
Mr. Chair, yes, it has been a problem, in particular with these flat storage facilities, because of the way that they're constructed versus a grain elevator where the drop height is very minimal. You load grain right at the very top, and it fills up. No emissions are occurring from a grain storage facility or a standard elevator. The loading happens at the drop site, goes up by conveyor, and the drop height creates these fugitive emissions, creates big plumes of dust. That's the complaints that we get of, around 20 per year, where neighbors who are dusted, we call it, they're dusted, their cars into their house, on their property. That's when we get the phone calls from concerned citizens and say, can you come out and do something regarding this nearby facility loading and unloading and causing these dusting episodes?
Question from Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it's a question, but where our facility is located in Fergus Falls, I don't know if there's any neighbors close by, so I can't imagine anyone complaining there. But I was thinking of those at harvest time, as I drive down into the valley just west of town on a certain day and the combines are going, I mean, it's like the fog has settled in on the valley. I can't imagine, if you're enforcing this, shutting down the harvest season just because those fugitive particles are floating around in the air. It's just part of the process. It just seems a little over the top to be so sensitive about something that does seem pretty minor to me. So I'm just saying I can't imagine the people that are complaining. They must live very close, because where I live, there's, you could complain about other things. Some folks live next to a lagoon or other things. That there's a manufacturer of dog food in my district. It has a smell, So I just think this rule is, again, extreme. If the federal government says this is really a top issue, I don't understand it, frankly.
Comment, Mr. Smith?
Mr. Chair, I think, this is not to say that we get complaints from every facility, every grain elevator, and every ethanol plant or other corn processing facilities every year. This is in aggregate, and there are often, there are hundreds of grain elevators out there, quite a few. There's 20, 25 ethanol facilities, other processors. It's not to say that we get complaints about everyone, but the locations where we've got residents nearby the facility, oftentimes these flat storage facilities are located on the edges of the property boundary, so they're very near a residential area, and those are the complaints that we get. And again, you know, we are not taking action against the normal agricultural fugitive emissions that occur. We don't have the authority to do that, but our authority does lie where we issue these larger permits for facilities like ethanol plants. We do have an obligation to follow federal regulations and evaluate what can be done to reduce emissions. And that really has been our approach. Not to say you can't do it. We don't shut folks down, but we do ask folks to consider when they're loading and unloading on windy days, if they have no best management practices in place. Our approach has been, hey, we got a complaint. What can we do to try to minimize fugitive dust issues leaving your site? Things like putting covers on, reducing drop height. Some facilities have been installing berms to create wind blocks. These are all the things and the process that we follow when we look at the complaints that we receive.
Mr. Chair, just
Representative Nornes.
Again, I have a hard time understanding the seriousness of what we're dealing with. It's not year-round. It's only during the harvest time, which may be only a matter of weeks or something to that effect. So even for the neighbors who have a problem, it doesn't continue to go, you know, daily, hourly, monthly. It just seems, again, so minor that it has to reach this level where we need legislation to fix it.
Representative Pearson.
So with the people who are, Mr. Chair, the people who are impacted then by this type of fugitive emissions, have we had any incidents of damages?
The testifiers?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members, you know, I guess I'm not aware of the issue of damages. I will say, I think, to the question about impacts, this particulate matter is a significant potential health impact. If you're suffering from asthma or COPD, where inhalation risks cause potential problems, that is the issue around particulate matter, and that's why EPA has standards around things like particulate matter at, you know, at various sizes, 10, 2.5. So fugitive dust is a significant health risk, and that's why EPA regulates it, as do we, for emission standards.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me what the word size or you're talking about a facility measurement of some sort, and there's a kind of a gray inference of what that might be. So is this a size by bushels on the ground or a size by quantity that's flowing through the facility? How are you indicating this is of sufficient size that we are going to be concerned versus when any of the farmers, I think for years, farmers have flat-stored grain, particularly corn, before it was shelled during a period of technological change. I mean, I can just go through. I've got a few years of history that I am burdened by in my head, and I can't imagine how this is developing. I get the point that one person may live directly downstream from a loading facility. I can get that, but what is the increment of size that you are using?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, members, the size of needing a permit with us is based on the potential to emit. So we will look at an entire facility and review things like emissions leaving their stack or leaving generators or leaving cooling towers. We'll look at all that in aggregate. And if you are above, this is how the Clean Air Act works. If you're above a certain standard, you'll need a certain kind of permit. So over 100 tons per year needs a certain standard. If you're over 250 tons per year, you'll need a different kind of permit. So that's the way that we evaluate the size of the facility that needs a permit.
A quick follow-up?
Yep, quick follow-up. Does the same thing that you're doing then impact a future application for permit renewal or permit generation?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, yes, that they will provide to us changes to the facility. If they make reductions to emissions, then we can reduce the kind of permit. We have very simple and straightforward permits that cover most of the grain elevators in the state of Minnesota. Very easy for them to comply with the permit. The reporting requirements are very straightforward and simple. For an ethanol plant, again, because it's a larger potential emitter of pollutants, that's why they're in the permit they have, and that's why we take those permits. We look at those a little closer because those are higher risk potentially, and we want to make sure that we are doing all we can, one, because we have to under the Clean Air Act, but because we ought to because of the risk potential from that particular facility.
You talk about the ease of permitting, but should they take 2 or 3 years to be completed?
Mr. Chair, you know, to be fair, the length of time required for that was primarily based on changes the facility owner was proposing that drove the timelines for that. We did have some delay, and we do work very closely with the ethanol plants. We have worked very closely with Mr. Miller to accommodate his desire for growth. We certainly support that. We want to see that happen, but we want to make sure that's happening in a fair process and that it complies with state and federal regulations and it protects human health and the environment.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Smith, you said that there are examples where, well, first of all, the permitting, am I correct that grain elevators do receive a permit and are affected by this, or are they not?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, yes, grain elevators do receive permits from the MPCA. They're called registration permits. Again, very short, very straightforward. We typically do not, because we're given limited resources, we're focusing on the biggest risks, the largest permits first, as well as we respond to complaints. So we are typically not out looking at grain elevators and flat storage facilities for grain elevators unless we receive a complaint regarding that particular facility.
Follow up, Representative.
Yeah, thank you. And also in your testimony, you suggested that there are facilities that meet these standards. And if I read by the tone of the voice, that you suggested it wasn't that challenging for them to do that. Can you explain that to us better?
Thanks. Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, yes. There are about 5 or 6 facilities in the state that fall under the BACR rule, and we want to work with those facilities. Those facilities have met the requirements for, carefully adjusting their process and operation to comply with BACR, as well as our overall, more important goal of reducing emissions at the property boundary.
One more follow-up, Representative.
I've got about 2 or 3. Okay.
we have a... I understand. This is invoking some passion, so go ahead.
I'm trying to figure it out. So, and those are readily met through a portable facility, or I'm thinking of a permanent facility that's on 169 and for additional grain that's at a large grain elevator near Lake Crystal. Is that it, or are you talking about, are these portable facilities able to meet the standards?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, members, the word temporary, I think, is somewhat of a tough term to get our hands around here. These are, in our mind, these are more permanent-type facilities. They are constructed basins made out of concrete. They sit oftentimes in the ground. Imagine a hockey rink, if you would, with a cover that they can roll on and off with machinery that loads and unloads grain. So... I think the definitions are important but not critical in that, even if the law applies here, and we think it does, the most important thing for us is to make sure that these facilities are not creating problems outside the property boundary. So I'm not familiar with the one you're specifically talking about, but...
I do want to answer that question because... You know, you drive the countryside, you see any number of the hockey rink-style facility, some with covers, some without. Are any of those hockey rink-style with not a permanent concrete roof over them, are any of these meeting the standards?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, it's difficult for me to say without knowing which ones you're talking about, but many of them do. Based on location, you can comply with the BACR, with the regulations, if your facility is located a significant distance away from the property boundary. Again, our goal, and through BACR, our goal is to have, you know, 0 to 5% emissions of fugitives at the property boundary. So if you've placed, you know, without knowing exactly which one you're talking about, if you've placed your location or your flat storage facility in the middle of a 40 acres, or, you know, I'm giving an extreme example here, they typically will comply with BACR because at that point, these are heavier particles. They do not drift very far. And if you place them appropriately, they do comply. And then we don't get complaints about those. So that's one of our goals, is to work with regulated parties early on in the process to make sure that they are locating these facilities. We don't have a general problem with the facilities, but locate them in a place where you're not causing problems by putting them too close to a property boundary or a neighbor who might call and complain.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And like my fellow Representative Johnson, I have so many questions, and I know we have so little time, so I won't go down that road.
Pick your best one.
I will. I'm going to pick my best one. You might not like it. I do want to make a very brief comment, very brief because of our time, but I'm just going to sum it up as this. To you, you do not represent the entire MPCA, but if you want to understand the frustration of agriculture on what MPCA is doing to them, it's being summed up in this one single meeting right here. I can give you a dozen examples of what's going on, that you are crushing rural Minnesota. You are crushing them. And I'm so frustrated, and it's not just you, so I don't want to take it out on you, but take it back to your leadership and let them know that they are killing us. And that's why we have to come up with legislation like this. But the question that I have, Mr. Chair, is I'm hearing a lot of things that are being sold from their perspective, and I'm wondering if our previous testifiers would like to, you're making a lot of broad statements about, well, we think it's this and we think it's that. Do the previous testifiers have any input on what they'd like to say about this?
Folks, keep the night open. We might be back tonight, so that's fine. Mr. Miller.
Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. I'll keep it brief. I know time is very important to you folks. There was a couple comments made about receiving approximately 20 complaints per year. Mr. Smith's staff have told me face-to-face that they've received a couple of complaints related to flat storage facilities. So we have several grain elevators in the small community of Morris, 5,000 people. They're right downtown. They're right next to Dairy Queen. They're right next to the law office. Our ethanol plant sits on the outskirts. There is all kinds of dust and bees wings that float around in these smaller communities during the harvest season. We're in rural America. Agriculture is important to all of us. Obviously, you can see the passion. Our industry is full of it as well, so I certainly appreciate it. But one thing we need to keep in mind, and getting back to just common sense, we're never going to please everyone. There always will be complaints, but I think it's important to understand truly where are the complaints being driven from. What type of complaints, what types of impacts are being had? Is there physical damage, or are we just talking about a little bit of grain dust that that might be floating around? There have been zero complaints on our facility. I've been told that. There have been. I've also been told from PCA staff, from the permitting folks, that there's been complaints related to a couple, two or three flat storage facilities in Minnesota, not 20.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Representative Miller.
How much is it going to cost to comply with this, Mr. Miller?
Our current negotiations, we've settled on roughly using best management practices and improvements over the next few years, roughly $500,000. We spent $1.1 million building the facility. It's paved roads. It's a brand new scale shack, very safe for our farmers, very, very convenient, quick and easy. It is a ring-style bunker, so there are concrete border walls that kind of contains the grain, and then we do cover it as soon as we're done filling it with a tarp, and then it gets uncovered when we reclaim the grain. But to spend $500,000 is one thing. It may not sound like a lot of money to some of you, and it may sound like a ton of money to others. It's a ton of money to me in our small business. We're operating under very thin margins, dealing with commodities, and the ultimate concern I have here is that we are willing and ready to be in compliance at the federal level and can prove that, and I don't need additional state regulation that is more burdensome than what the federal requirement wants me to do. The other thing is that if I look at the agreement that's been proposed as far as the changes to make in order to try to comply and spend another $500,000, there is absolutely zero difference in what's going to happen to emissions, because we're not collecting them. We're just trying to contain them, if you will, removing them from one area of the property to the other. There are certainly things that we're planning on doing, regardless of what the outcome is today, in order to try to make a better environment for the farmers delivering grain. We don't have neighbors. There's nobody that lives within a mile of this facility. There's virtually no problems, but it goes beyond just us. We're talking about rural America and the grain that needs to move during harvest. This is a serious matter, and we can't get into a situation where these facilities are at such burden where they're not able to take that surge volume during the fall conditions.
And the costs, good comment, good questions. And again, the cost that the company has to pay, of course, is passed on to the farmer in terms of a widened basis. Basis, by the way, is a difference in the cost of transportation, storage, how to run the elevator, the ethanol plant. So that's deducted off what the Chicago Board of Trade price is, and that's what the farmers are left with. So when their costs increase, those costs are passed directly back on to the farmer in a lower price for what they receive for their grain. So this affects all those that work with the plants. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's Mr. Smith. I'm kind of wondering here, this particular bill, it sounds like multiple large facilities are complying with these particular rules. So would this bill affect just this particular facility, or would this bill affect a half a dozen or 20 or 20, I don't even know how many ethanol plants we have in the state, but 25, 30, I don't know. How many, what is this bill going to affect? One facility or multiples?
Mr. Smith or Vice Chair Backer? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, so right now it would impact probably the five or six that currently have permits covering this flat storage facility. But beyond this, in the next few years, if someone wanted to construct a flat storage facility, then they would not need to, follow state and federal regulations. And for us, that means they'd be in non-compliance with the federal regulations. But it could be because there is quite a bit of interest in the use of flat storage facilities, that it could be growing as the years go by. We certainly have been asked over the years from probably another five, six of the ethanol facilities alone, if they could consider or they are considering building these flat storage type facilities. It's not just these. It's anybody who is processing and storing grain that might take advantage of using these types of storage facilities.
Representative.
And could you go over what you call your remediation practices? Are we talking paving roads, or are we talking large canvas tarps, or lowering the auger, that the drop space for the auger, from 20 feet down to 2 feet? Or could you go over that just a little bit more for me? Because this bill seems like it's really looking to fix a problem for one or two people, but has the potential to become more problematic as these things grow around the state.
I'd like to comment.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, this is not what this really does, Representative and Chair, is it really puts in check some common sense. I mean, are we going, when is a fugitive emission? Go out in the rural, it blows. So are we going to try to outlaw wind? That is really where we're at. I am not bringing this just because of Morris. I'm bringing this for common sense, not just for rural America, but we have agencies that are misinterpreting. We're using the word pollution. This is dust, folks. Biodegradable dust. This ain't CO2 emissions. I'm a chemist. I mean, this is how crazy we're seeing this interpretation. So I want to clearly let you know this is just not for a place. This is really to defend the common folks who are trying to make a living.
Well, Mr. Chair, to that particular comment, common sense gets thrown around here so many times, and common sense is in the eye of the beholder. So I would prefer to have a scientific basis for common sense. So if I could get my questions answered without interruption about what is the remediation and what are the costs. I mean, that's all I'm asking. That seems like common sense to get answers to questions rather than to parade some statement about common sense and telling people like that might have a question about this that we are stupid or unthinking or insensitive to greater Minnesota. I take great offense at the idea that you are impugning my desire to help greater Minnesota when I ask a question. That's not fair, that's not appropriate, and it shouldn't happen here. So if Mr. Smith can answer my question, I would appreciate it.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, members, our approach when it comes to fugitive emissions has been one of, escalating best management practices from the cheapest, most reasonable, most effective to the costliest. We do not jump right to you need to put an expensive cover on these facilities. Our first goal is to consider your loading and unloading periods of time. Is the wind blowing over 10 miles an hour? From which direction? Is it blowing towards the property boundary or away from the property boundary? So the first easiest response when people think about fugitive emissions is, can we keep the emissions away from the property boundary? So that can be done through some very straightforward and simple best management practices, like reducing your drop height from the auger to the pile, covering the pile immediately. Some folks will wet some material, and that doesn't always apply to grain, but there are some other fugitives like gravel or sand that does happen. We have folks consider putting shrouds over the drop ends. We have people considering putting up wind blocks, trees, or other barriers to stop the wind from pushing materials. We do have folks that do some testing during that time to prove that they're getting emissions down below visible particulates at the property boundary, and then it escalates from there to more permanent covers, moving drop heights, moving locations. All those things are more expensive, so we're not trying to have this be a huge burden financially or operationally for a facility, but we do want folks, when we get complaints in particular, to do things that make sense, that are reasonable, both to stay in operation. We want folks to prosper and be in operation. We also want to make sure that we're controlling emissions the way that we're asked to through state and federal regulations.
Questions, Representative Poppy?
I'll pass.
I would just quickly ask Mr. Smith, if the cost to retrofit the pile in Morris is in fact $500,000, taking in mind the size of that ethanol plant, and I don't think that's one of the bigger plants we have in the state, do you think the cost-benefit analysis of that makes sense? It makes an economic, financial sense?
Mr. Chair, I guess it's – I don't – I've not looked at the numbers. I take Mr. Miller at his word, many facilities have spent more than that and have given that thought up front and placed flat storage facilities either to control emissions or in locations ahead of time where this would not be a problem.
So I'm not sure when they began construction or planning that facility. Were they made aware at the time that this different interpretation was going to be part of the equation?
Mr. Chair, again, we disagree that there's been any different interpretation. The bulk egg commodity rule has been in play the entire time. We have applied it where it's been appropriate. When this flat storage facility was first constructed, there was some disagreement about whether and what kind of permit was required. From our perspective, it was constructed under some incomplete information supplied by the consultant and the facility, and it wasn't until after it was built that we had concerns about it. And at that point, we were doing all we could do to, again, keep them allowing to use it and to permit that facility, but also keep them moving towards compliance with state and federal regulations, and more importantly, the emissions that we have seen leaving that facility at the property boundary.
Mr. Smith, flat storage has been with us for years and years and years, and we're just hearing about this now, recently. So you say you haven't changed your interpretation something seems to have changed in the last year or so.
Mr. Chair, I think what has been changing has been we've seen expansion or a desire for the use of flat storage facility.
Yes.
And so that has been, you know, under certain circumstances where it's a larger, more potentially impactful location or emission source, that has, I think, moved us all into asking some more questions and making sure that we are engaging with regulated parties, whether it's an ethanol plant or a grain elevator where we get a complaint. Again, our approach has always been the same. If, you know, the laws apply, but our goal is to minimize emissions.
Representative Nornes.
Mr. Chair, just one quick question to Mr. Miller, if you can answer this. Has your company already been fined by the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Miller.
Representative, members of the committee, yes, we have recently received a fine for for our NPDS permit, stormwater runoff. We got dragged through the mud last week while I was out of the office. We paid a fine of an amount of $22,000, which were virtually for administrative errors over the last 7 years. We received two audits from the PCA in 2017. We agreed to pay those penalties. I should have hired an attorney. We absolutely could have fought and won. I strongheartedly believe that. We paid those fines in effort to try to get our air permit. Again, we're waiting for a renewed air permit for over 2 years. Had I known the outcome and the phone calls that I would have received from community members, concerned legislators about this, you know, Denco, the ethanol plant, supposedly polluting groundwater, the Pomme de Terre River, that is absolutely not true. Our fines were related to administrative activities such as capturing a stormwater runoff sample. It started to rain on a Friday evening. Our operations team goes out, grabs a sample in a certified capture area where we collect a sample of runoff, put it in the fridge in the lab. Unfortunately, can't mail that out overnight to the third-party lab to provide the analysis on it. There's only a 24-hour hold period on it written in our permit, so that's a violation. Other examples, we're supposed to report certain discharge limits at 0.2 milligrams per liter or less. We reported it as 0.15. The actual, that is less than 0.2. That's a violation because it was supposed to be reported as 0.2 or less. Another example would be on a windy day during the inspection. We have two cooling towers on site. They're enforced draft, induced draft cooling tower. It was very windy. There was a little bit of misting from the cooling tower. Imagine the wind blowing 30 miles an hour in west central Minnesota. There was a small puddle of water next to the cooling tower basin. Now, granted, we're permitted to discharge that cooling tower water, which we do 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days out of the year, to the Pomme de Terre River. Not directly, indirectly. That is written in our permit. But potentially that small puddle of water could flow on its own, not through the regulated pipe that is hard piped within our facility. That was a violation. So it's things like that. I'm certainly not proud of those. I feel from an administrative perspective we can improve at the plant level and make sure that our administrative compliance and our reporting is to the nth degree. But we are good stewards, and we are not polluting the environment, and we are certainly not doing the things and how the PCA's press release was released last Tuesday. That is an absolute false indication of what's happening in rural America. But unfortunately, yes, to answer your question, we have been fined.
Right. I only ask the question because I think it points out, as it was mentioned earlier, the attack on agriculture seems to be pretty obvious. So,
any other questions from members? Anybody in the audience care to comment further on this? Yes, sir. Go ahead. Mr. Bordosky.
Yes, members of the committee. There's been a lot of stuff talked about. I just want to cap on a couple things. I know the MPCA expressed concern about this rule change opening the door for additional pollution from this type of activity, and that there's the concerns for some of these existing facilities in Minnesota. Generally speaking, that characterization, however, is that the areas where this is an issue is the sources that aren't regulated or aren't subject to the bulk gate commodity rule anyways, because they don't have the throughput necessary or their family farm. Those are the two exclusions where they don't get pulled into the bulk gate commodity rule. If this flat storage that's across from Denco were owned by somebody other than Denco 2, it would not be subject to this rule, because right now the issue is it's a part of the facility. The facility of Denco 2, the ethanol plant, has a throughput that triggers the bulk A commodity rule, and therefore this flat storage is then subject to this opacity regulation. And that's where it gets challenging, is basically to say that regardless of the fact that the throughput on the flat storage is very low relative to the throughput thresholds, the triggers, it's still subject, and that's where it becomes a challenge, because this is truly meant as a surge for harvest time, and that's, I guess, what I think we're trying to get at with this bill.
Thanks for that clarification. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. I hesitate to make this comment, but I wanted to encourage us not to try to turn this into a cultural war or blame one side for attacking rural Minnesota. I happen to live in outstate Minnesota. I represent rural folks, and rural Minnesota is not monolithic. They don't always agree on everything. In this particular case, I don't know whether the case is valid or not. We haven't heard enough information to make a decision necessarily. But I take great offense when we assume that trying to regulate an industry that needs to be regulated, that we accuse those who wish to regulate it and protect citizens in rural Minnesota, that they're at war or that they're attacking them or that they're going to put them out of business entirely. Because I know that of neighbors who object to something that a neighboring farmer might be doing and they feel it threatens them. I know of children and people who have asthma and where dust coming over into their property and can cause great harm. And it bothers me that, you know, let's keep it to this individual case. We don't have to make it an argument about are we at war with each other. This bears on the coming bills we're going to hear as well, and I just assume that we talk about the issues and let different sides represent their case rather than turning it into a cultural battle that I don't think we need to go down. Thank you.
Further comments on your bill, Representative Backer?
I do, but in light of time, I will ask for your support.
And you will renew your motion?
Yes, I will renew my motion. Thank you. And this will go to Environmental. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Environment and Natural Resources Committee. All those in favor?
Mr. Chair, I would ask for a roll call vote, please.
Roll call has been called for. Roll call will be taken. And my man to the right will call off the names. Chair Anderson votes aye.
Backer?
Aye.
Bennett?
Aye.
Bly?
No.
Daniels?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Kunesh-Podein?
Aye.
Lewick? Mahoney? Mariani? Miller?
Aye.
Munson?
Aye.
Nornis?
Aye.
Poston? Sauk?
Yes. Yeah, abstained.
You missed a page.
Okay.
We got Poppy.
Pearson.
Pearson, Poppy.
Either Poppy? Gene? Poppy?
Poppy?
Aye.
The roll call vote was 12 ayes, 1 nay, and 1 abstention. With that, the motion passes, and the bill is on its way to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee. Thank you, Representative Backer, Vice Chair Backer. Next up, our special guest this morning. Didn't think it was going to take this long to get to Commissioner Fredrickson. And again, bear in mind, we have reserved room 120 tonight if we need it. So, you're going to come, somebody going to come down from the Department of Ag? Okay. Just like to have an overview of the nitrogen rule that was in the news again last week. Good morning, Commissioner Fredrickson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I haven't been introduced as special guest before, so I was wondering which special guest you wanted down here.
Well, consider yourself a special guest.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you. It's good to be here. Good to get an opportunity to talk about the nitrogen fertilizer management rule that we've been involved in for a long time. Again, good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and certainly thank you for the opportunity to join you this morning. My name is Dave Fredrickson, and I serve as the Commissioner of Agriculture. Ag is, as you heard early on, this is a cornerstone of our state's economy. Our farmers contribute immensely to the social and the economic fabric of our state. A key ingredient to a strong and successful farm economy is indeed access to clean water. After all, good water makes good food. It's certainly no secret that access to safe, clean water has long been a pillar of success for our agriculture and food economy and Minnesota's high quality of life. Our water in Minnesota also contributes to the social fabric of the state. Farmers, agribusiness, and all Minnesotans understand and appreciate that access to clean water is vital to their economic success. At the Department of Agriculture, we're charged with a unique but I think appropriate mission to enhance our farm economy and protect the health of our environment. It's in our mission. In Minnesota and across the country, we face challenges with excessive nitrate in our groundwater. Some of this, indeed, is naturally occurring, but a large percentage is being contributed by human activity. Since the passage of the Groundwater Protection Act in 1989, the department has sought to educate Minnesotans and promote efficient fertilizer use, whether it is used in farm fields, in flower beds, or in gardens. As directed by the Groundwater Protection Act, the department has developed a nitrogen fertilizer management plan, which is the state's blueprint for how we will work together to address elevated nitrate levels in our groundwater. The first nitrogen fertilizer management plan was drafted in 1990. In 2010, under Governor Plenty, the MDA began a revision of the nitrogen fertilizer management plan. This revised plan was developed in consultation with an advisory committee comprised of Minnesota farmers, agronomists, commodity groups, and environmental organizations. The revision process lasted 5 years, and MDA addressed 420 written comments before finalizing the plan in 2015. The plan is rooted in science, and it's practical. It outlines both voluntary and regulatory approaches to address groundwater challenges across our state. Last summer, the department released an informal draft rule. This informal draft rule was intended to solicit feedback and begin a conversation about the groundwater challenges we face. As part of our commitment to public engagement, we took an unprecedented approach, and we held 17 listening sessions across the state. We also met with any farm and environmental organization or group that was interested in learning more about the rule. In total, we met with more than 1,500 people, received 820 written comments. As you can imagine, the feedback we received touched and challenged every part of the draft rule. As I said last summer, and my apologies to Representative Mahoney, the final rule will have a healthy dose of common sense in it. Last week, after many months of work, Governor Dayton and I announced a revised groundwater protection rule. This new rule will focus strictly on areas of the state that have coarse textured soils. and where drinking water protection areas exist. These are the most vulnerable areas of the state for groundwater contamination, and we have an obligation to work with farmers, landowners, and local communities to protect these vital resources. Again, this is a common sense approach that will provide positive impacts to our state groundwater quality, yet reasonable and balanced enough to understand that farmers in these areas of the state need to make a living. The draft nitrogen fertilizer rule released in June of 2017 was not and will not be the final rule. It was a discussion draft. In releasing a draft rule and holding an informal comment period, the agency was able to continue its longstanding record of a robust public engagement regarding nitrogen fertilizer use. As we continue to roll this rule out, I will personally be traveling across the state to present the draft rule to farmers and any interested Minnesotan. In addition to presenting the rule, my team and I will continue to listen and continue to work with farmers, local communities to refine and improve the rule. Mr. Chair and members, we do have a problem with nitrates in our groundwater, and as policymakers, we have a legal and we have a moral obligation to address it. More than 50% of Minnesotans rely on groundwater-based public water systems for their drinking water, and the approach that the department is taking to this rule is reasonable, it is practicable, and it is science-based. If you look at 103H and look at the preamble, they use the word practical, and I've told you this before, Mr. Chairman, four times. I understand what practical means. It means common sense. Common sense means practical, and that's what we hope to bring to this discussion today. Mr. Chairman and members, I'm pleased to try to answer any questions you might have. I'm joined by my colleague and assistant commissioner at the Department of Ag, Ms. Susan Stokes.
Good morning, Ms. Stokes. Questions from members or none that I see? My first question, Commissioner Ms. Stokes. On your map, the shaded areas, and that has changed a great deal from the original map that came up. The shaded areas, fall restrictions, are we talking about just nitrogen or all fall applications of fertilizer?
All fall. We're talking, Mr. Chairman and members, this is the nitrogen rule, nitrogen fertilizer rule.
Okay.
It's nitrogen. So whether it's in the form of a liquid, in the form of anhydrous ammonia or gas, or whether it's in the form of urea. It's nitrogen fertilizer.
Commissioner, I checked with my crop consultant this morning, and if I wanted to put on in the fall my P and K, phosphorus, potassium, on an analysis that has 80 pounds of each of those two in it, there's going to be about 25 to 30 pounds of nitrogen. Would that restrict me from applying P and K in the fall?
With DAP and MAP, we're looking at 40 pounds, and so okay. You should be in good shape.
Okay, very good, very good. More questions? This is our chance. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank the department for the efforts that you made to go around the state and hear the people. And I want to remind us all, this does relate to the other issue as well. This is fundamentally a health issue, and I think it's a brave Department of Agriculture to go after this one. But as one who represents the city of St. Peter, which is impacted by this rule because of the wellhead protection area, I want the people to know that the city of St. Peter years ago put in a reverse osmosis system, and the citizens of that community have been paying for years for that reverse osmosis system due to nitrates. And they've done it very quietly. They've just went ahead and did it. I also want to refer to a gentleman who farms in that wellhead protection area who was at our town hall meeting the other day, who said he thoroughly understands that because he farms in that wellhead protection area that he has some different responsibilities. And I hope that's the attitude that we come and that the background that we come to this discussion today. Because based on the last issue, I think this can be heated as well. But this is a fundamental health issue related to drinking water that affects young children. Thank you very much.
comment, Commissioner, Ms. Stokes? Okay. Mr. Commissioner, the first go-around, the first draft, you released that and you did make efforts to get all over the state. I thank you for that. Your comment period was 78 days after that one, and now on this one you're looking at a 30-day comment period. Could that be made longer, or what's the reason for the 30-day period the second time? Ms. Stokes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is some flexibility in that date, and we're hearing requests to extend it, and we'll take those under advisement. We're working under an administrative rulemaking process, and there are multiple requirements behind the scenes about where the drafts have to go and how long each party gets at MMB or the administrative law judge. But we have heard those comments, and we will look at a longer period. There also will be additional opportunities to comment this summer when we have our hearings before the administrative law judge. We intend to hold those around the state, and we'll be taking oral testimony at those as well.
Thank you. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I thank you for your work. Thank you. I know that this has been a long time. It's been a work of art as much as science, and so I appreciate that you've been spending the time on that. But I would say a couple of things. One is that to get the rule out as soon as possible. I know that that also is a part of the time frame that you have to deal with, but that's certainly something that I've heard, that people would like to see it sooner rather than later. If you can extend the comment period from 30 days to 60 or something, it also comes out at a time when farmers will be busy. So we want to be able to have that opportunity that they can comment, that they can review it, they can understand it. Have statewide meetings. Again, I appreciate that you've done that. And even statewide meetings in places that might not be the largest city in a region, but maybe some of the smaller towns and some of the smaller communities, so that people can feel as though they're able to get to a meeting and they feel more comfortable. You know, sometimes in a large facility, you might not feel as safe to be able to comment. And so just that would be the other thing. And then I know there potentially are exemptions. And maybe just to be able to clarify that as you go through the process too, that if there's, you know, what that might be and how that looks so that people can know how they are going to be impacted.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we intend to get the rule published as soon as possible. We have to get a couple weeks' notice to the Federal Register, and something called the Statement of Need and Reasonableness has to be published with it. So those have to go together. So we will get those out just as quickly as we can. And so I just wanted to assure you of that.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one other thing on the map. I know that the DISMAs, whatever you say that, the green ones, you can kind of see a couple, but you can't see a lot of them. So I don't know if there's just, purple map is good, but a green map would be good too, just so that people can know how they're impacted within. So as the clarity is going to be important, clarity and communication, transparency, all of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Poppy, Mr. Chairman. You're right that there are 31 DWISMAs, which are commonly referred to as drinking water supply management areas. Those green spots are literally buried under the purple. There are 31 of them. The largest would be Wellhead Protection Area in and around Hastings, which would be about 59,000 acres. The smallest would be probably in Rock County, way down in the lower left-hand corner, and that would be about 200 acres. And so the focus on DWISMAs, for lack of a better word, is the idea that you want to impact the most people on this issue. And so thus the focus on those green areas. But we'll make sure that they're lifted out of that purple area. What do you get when you make green and purple? Do you get what color? No? Gray. Yeah.
Ms. Stokes, looking at the press release, and I appreciate that, level three, we bring in what's called a local advisory team. Could you talk about who that is and what they would be empowered with?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The local advisory teams will be groups of local farmers and agronomists that will advise the commissioner as these areas move through the levels of what we're calling part two of the rules. So, and we already have begun working on these under the nitrogen management fertilizer plan. We've stood up four of these local advisory teams already, and it's our view that it's going to the best chance of succeeding in addressing the nitrate issue is going to be working with local farmers and local agronomists in understanding what practices and what best management practices will work in those areas. With regards to the revised rule, what will happen is before any regulation can be imposed in these DWSMAs, the commissioner will be required to consult with those local advisory teams before coming up with specific orders about what practices should be required in those areas. And they'll start, of course, with the best management practices, but then based a lot on what we heard from the feedback at the listening sessions, and you attended one of those, we heard comments over and over about the precision ag methods that farmers are already using, those local advisory teams will be able to bring that expertise into the process as it goes through in those areas.
Thank you. So beginning at the level three is where the mandatory BMPs would begin to take place?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Only in the drinking water supply management areas, and I think that's justified because we're impacting a serious amount of people.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in that in our personal lives, oftentimes these kinds of things silo away from us rather than being in a form that we included into our cognizant world. I happen to live very close to one of these green dots over here, or at least I used to, and then we moved to Rochester where we have city water, so we sort of ignore this issue of pollutants in wells. That area around Plainview, which is what is that one green spot down there that can be seen relatively easily, almost everybody knows that when they're drilling a well, they probably aren't going to be successful unless they go extraordinarily deep. I'm wondering if there's a cross or a confluence of this information across all of the kinds of times that it might enter into somebody's life, not just farmers. It would be, health department for well drilling, zoning issues for, again, well drilling that would happen. So that sometimes this stuff silos itself so much that it's almost like you couldn't see it unless you happened to be able to get at it from a different place.
I think there's a question there.
Yeah,
I'm
sorry,
Commissioner.
Chairman,
yeah, I don't mean to be glib about it, but we're operating under 103H, which was required by the legislature. And so the siloing really occurs in the chapter. These are our responsibilities. Yes, there are other agencies that have other responsibilities in terms of water, but this is ours. And we have, again, rulemaking authority under 103H.
Yeah.
I'm struggling to get to the...
Quickly, Representative.
Yep. I think that's an adequate answer for what I was fishing for, because I'm really only struggling to find out how somebody who is just a person, not specifically in one of these areas, or these agricultural endeavors, that they would be afforded this information, which is critical because this is the tainting of their well water. But, okay, thank you.
In Minnesota, Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Commissioner,
we do have silos, but we're good at connecting them with skywalks rather than tearing them down. So we work together with other state agencies continuously, and health is certainly one of them.
We're going to get our testifiers up here in just a second. In the meantime, Kirby Hetver, you're up, and Kevin Papp on deck, Mark Game, and Gretchen Sable. Representative Vice Chair Backer.
No.
Oh, okay.
Forget it.
Let's go to our testifiers then. Kirby Hetver. Good morning, sir. Identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kirby Hetver. I currently serve as president of the Minnesota Corn Growers Association at farm near DeGraff, Minnesota. The proposed nitrogen fertilizer rule being developed by the Minnesota Department of Ag has been a subject of a lot of discussion, obviously, and some controversy among farm organizations, conservation groups, and other stakeholders. The Minnesota Corn Growers Association has played a constructive role in the process with goals of ensuring the rule is fair, based on accepted science, and implemented in a manner that does not impose undue hardship on Minnesota farmers, especially during this time of economic stress throughout farm country. I would like to highlight three issues today for the committee. First, Minnesota Corn Growers Association's concerns about the proposed rule. Second, Minnesota Corn Growers Association's concerns about the remaining process. And third, I'd like to speak a little bit to the actions that Minnesota corn farmers are doing to increase nitrogen use efficiency and mitigate our impacts. First, Minnesota corn growers' concerns about the proposed rule. As expressed this morning, there are some, based on some comments that we submitted to MDA last summer with the initial draft proposal. First, for mapping, we need specificity and transparency with regards to the criteria used to develop the vulnerable areas of the map. In addition to soils and geological data, those things should be based on monitoring data as well. Section boundaries are too coarse for prohibiting fall and frozen soil applications of nitrogen fertilizer, given that we do manage farms at the field and subfield scale. The 20-pound per acre total nitrogen limit associated with the fall MAP and DAP applications is too restrictive. We agree on that and have voiced our opinion. If you want more details on comments that we provided last summer, please feel free to go to minnesotacorn.org, where you can view not only our public comments, but all 800-plus public comments that were received by the Department of Ag. Addressing concerns about the process moving forward. At the press conference last week, Governor Dayton, Commissioner Frederickson outlines the revised timeline for the rule. And our primary concern is that with the current timeline being published in mid-May, we may be done planting corn or beans, but farmers like myself are going to be focused on crop protection and split nutrient application in season. So from a timing standpoint, it's not very good timing for us to reply. Additionally, a revised timeline indicates a 30-day public comment. I'm happy to hear that there might be some flexibility there. Whether it's similar to last summer's 75-day period or a 90-day period, which we would strongly support. We also need, farmers need to understand, again, how the draft rule will impact their specific farming operations and need to see interactive GIS maps. As we experienced with implementation of the buffer law, there were several errors in the detailed DNR maps that need to be addressed. Minnesota farmers need and deserve the same opportunity with adequate time to understand the impacts for their operation through detailed GIS maps. Finally, I'd like to provide some information on actions that Minnesota corn farmers are taking to increase nitrogen use efficiency and mitigate impacts. Minnesota's corn farmers are continuously working to improve and become better stewards of our state's natural resources while maintaining a thriving rural economy. That's why Minnesota Corn Growers has made a commitment to a very ambitious goal. Minnesota's corn farmers will become the most sustainable and environmentally responsible corn farmers in the United States. To work towards this goal, since 2014, corn farmers have invested nearly $6 million of our own funds through our corn checkoff in education and research, specifically around nitrogen. MCGA is working with leading researchers to develop best management practices that protect Minnesota's drinking water while maintaining productive farm operations. In addition to our investment with third-party researchers, we're also working with grower leaders, innovators out in the field through our Minnesota Corn Innovation Grant Program. These things help help farmers identify ways that might be best management practices down the road by thinking of new ideas on ways to better implement technology or practices on the farm. Efforts to ensure that proven research and innovative practices are translated to the field. Since 2015, we have spent $2.8 million on directed nitrogen-specific education programs. I'd like to highlight a program, the University of Minnesota Extension's Nitrogen Smart Program, which is helping farmers become more effective with their use of nitrogen. In closing, we appreciate that MDA has been working for the last couple years on this issue and working specifically in the last week to put out more details with the draft rule. We do especially appreciate the work that dedicated MDA staff is doing to put together these details as fast as possible. We do believe that for us to best inform our membership, we need to be able to evaluate the rule in its entirety and urge its full release. Because of our strong belief in addressing the concerns that I have outlined this morning and need to ensure corn farmers are able to fully participate in the public engagement, a letter submitted this morning by MCGA to Governor Dayton has been included in your packets. On behalf of Minnesota corn growers, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning on our concerns about the proposed rule, about the remainder of the process, and about the opportunity to share with you what we're doing to increase nitrogen efficiency. With that, Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hepper. Not seeing any. Kevin Pappin, we will also get to Steve Morris or Mike Hitfish, too. If you can't be back tonight, we'll get to you yet today. So we'll get the testifiers. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Papp. I'm president of Minnesota Farm Bureau. Minnesota Farm Bureau is the largest farm organization in the state. We have 78 county or regional farm bureaus and have over 30,000 member families. You know, as farmers who live on the land our families farm, we understand the importance of protecting our natural resources. And I'm not a lot different than any of the other farmers in the room today. You know, I'm fourth generation. The driveway I drove out of on the way to the Capitol was the same driveway our family used 119 years ago. In fact, if you don't count college, I've only ever lived in three houses on two farmyards a half a mile from each other. Why is that significant? Is because that's around 320 acres of farmland, a public drainage ditch that was built in 1944. And I say again that those farmers, all of us as farmers that live on the land that we farm, understand the importance of protecting our natural resources. We take our commitment to sustainability and land stewardship very seriously. We look forward to working with our legislators, government agencies, and researchers to develop new methods, new technologies to conserve our natural resources and protect our environment. We ask the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to increase their support of research and outreach that will continue to improve nutrient management processes. Agriculture, farming is all about continual improvement. Minnesota Farm Bureau believes the focus of this research should be on the most up-to-date best management practices, timed application of nitrogen, and the usage of precision agriculture. And with today's topics, I think all the topics included, we really believe in Farm Bureau in a regulatory process that is transparent, consistent, accountable, non-duplicative, and cost-effective, with open, fair, and early stakeholder involvement. We believe if you feel that the rulemaking process is fair you'll have a better understanding of those results. Farm Bureau members will continue working to create opportunities for continuous improvement in productivity, environmental quality, and human well-being. Be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Papp. Any questions? Seeing none, Mark Gamm. Hope I've got that correct. And then Gretchen Sable here on deck.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, thank you.
Good morning.
You're right. It's Mark Gamm. Okay. I work for Dodge County and here representing Dodge County. I'm the Environmental Service Director. I've been in that position for 28 years. And I want to just give you a little background about where we're coming from the nitrogen rulemaking process, but also House File 2727 and House File 2887. So in 1990, Dodge County adopted its local water management plan, just like many other counties in the state have done. The highest priority of our plan is the protection of groundwater. The bills, House File 2727 and House File 2887 regarding nitrogen fertilizer, will limit the ability of the Department of Agriculture to protect drinking water. Therefore, those bills are in direct conflict with our local water management plan. Dodge County is located in southeast Minnesota. About 70% of our land area is in row crop agriculture, primarily corn and soybeans. For the most part, farmers in Dodge County are good stewards of the land, environmental conscious, and in many cases, they're already adopting best management practices. Yet, our nitrogen concentrations are not reducing. They're not getting lower. Dodge County has been sampling groundwater wells in Dodge County for 20 years. We have over 2,500 samples collected from private wells, and that's over and above what the MDA has tested. Those tests indicate that 21% of the wells have nitrate in them above the background levels, and that 7% of those wells are drinking water that's above the health risk limit. In Dodge County, drinking water sources are highly vulnerable. They're part of that purple area. And those are areas that have shallow soils over limestone bedrock or over a sand aquifer. People living in those areas have even a higher chance of nitrate being in their groundwater above the health risk limit. So to reiterate, it appears that House File 2727 and House File 2887 conflict with the goals of the Dodge County Water Management Plan and reduce the options available to protect drinking water from fertilizer contamination. So thank you again for allowing me to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Gamm. Questions? Seeing none, Gretchen Sable. And then if they want to testify now, Steve Morris and Mike Petefish. Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. My name is Gretchen Sable. I'm here on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Minnesota, and I thank you for allowing me to testify. I think this may be the first time that League of Women Voters has been before the Ag Committee, and I'd like to say that we're doing this because LWV Minnesota is a nonprofit organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. We also work to increase understanding of major public policy issues and to influence policy through education and advocacy. We do take positions, though, on issues after a grassroots study and consensus process. We don't endorse political parties or candidates. Nutrient pollution, particularly nitrates in drinking water, is one of the issues that we're working on, though, so that's why I'm here today. We do oppose House Files 2727 and 2887. The Groundwater Protection Act, now codified in 103H, was written to protect the people of Minnesota who use groundwater for drinking water. This act laid out a process that's been followed closely by Department of Ag at a pace that has allowed for much public input and deliberation, as Commissioner Frederick outlined. More than 20 years after passage of this act, the MDA has proposed rules that follow the process laid out in the Administrative Procedures Act under MS 40, Minnesota Statutes 14. The nitrogen fertilizer rule proposed by MDA takes the next step in implementing that, and public input has been sought all along the way. Despite all the voluntary actions that have been taken to date, we see nitrate increasing in our water, and that's a major concern for people that consume the water, many of our League of Women Voters members. We see public and private wells impacted. We did submit a handout that documents some of that, so I won't go through that. But we do believe there's a pressing need for additional action to reduce nitrogen loading to our groundwater, even from agricultural nitrogen fertilizers. To stop or slow action on reducing this is irresponsible. The bills before you today would prevent the Department of Ag from taking the required next steps to implement the act and remove the rights of those citizens that have participated in the process to date. The draft fertilizer rule is the first of many steps that will need to be taken to reduce the level of nutrients lost from agricultural sources. The Groundwater Protection Act provides a process for reducing contamination of groundwater. The law's application to nitrates is overdue, given the number of public and private water supplies now impacted by elevated nitrates. We appreciate the work the Department of Agriculture has undertaken to implement this law, and we urge the process be allowed to continue. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Sable. Are you representing the state organization or a local organization?
The League of Women Voters exists at many levels, and so I belong to League of Women Voters ABC in the Anoka area. I'm here representing League of Women Voters Minnesota, which lobbies on state issues, and I'm also chair of the League of Women Voters of the Upper Mississippi, a multi-state organization that addresses nutrient issues in the Mississippi.
Thank you very much. Questions? Seeing none, must be getting close to lunch. Good morning, Mr. Morris. Identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Steve Morris. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Environmental Partnership, and we're the state's largest coalition of environmental conservation organizations. And I have a couple of handouts. Can I possibly
sure.
get those?
Our page is right here on the spot.
Great, thank you. I will note, but won't go into details, that it was 30 years ago that I, as a member of the state Senate, introduced our first groundwater legislation, and 29 years ago that as chief author I passed and shepherded this legislation through the legislature. And there are a lot of pieces of that bill that have been enacted in the preceding almost 30 years after that. But what hasn't been done until this time is for the Department of Ag to actually step forward and say, we're going to use our regulatory authority to protect the waters of the state of Minnesota, specifically through using these water resource protection requirements. So I want to say, just make three points, and I'll try to be quick. There are some really good things, there are some bad things, and coming up, there are some worse bad things. And I'm not going to say good, bad, and ugly, but it's kind of like that.
Thank you.
So the good things are that we're really happy to see the department moving forward, recognizing that this is a definite public health risk and a public health threat. I'm handing out two pieces of paper. If you look to the back of this sheet here where it lists the communities that have drinking water levels that are elevated water levels, and then we also put on here those high and very high crop acres that are in row crops. And that is really the primary driver of these elevated nitrogen levels in our drinking water supplies. And so if you look across this list in my home area, for example, of Lewiston, Spring Grove, and southeast Minnesota, you'll see a number of acres that are currently in row crop agriculture where we have elevated drinking water supplies for our public. This is a very targeted approach that isn't a scattershot across the whole state, but it's a targeted approach the department is taking to protect these public drinking water supplies. In southeast Minnesota, in my home county of Winona, 19% of the wells that are tested are already in excess of the public drinking water level, the safe drinking water level. So we're glad to see moving forward. The second point I want to make is that we definitely see shortcomings in this rule as well. Number one, the process is too slow, as you just heard in the testimony from Ms. Sable. We're doing these practices, as you heard from Dodge County, we're doing these practices. Farmers, as you heard from the corn growers, are doing better and better about efficiency. The problem is the rates still keep going up. It's not just about how we get efficiency of our fertilizer. It's about more fundamental change, how we put cropping systems in place, how we put different crops and cover crops in place that will actually make this difference. So we think the response time is still way too slow and the rule implementation is way too slow. As we get into more details of the rule, we see more limits coming in to limit the agency's authority, which we're concerned with, because we really have to get to some of these changes to protect the public health. Thirdly, there's obviously a big hole in that we're not protecting the private waters wells. I have a private water well in rural Winona County where we have this high level of contamination, and we should be doing more to protect all those people on private water supplies across rural Minnesota. This really ducks that. That being said, the last thing we'd want to see is have the legislature intervene and stop the process by stopping the rule or in some way limiting the commissioner's authority to move ahead. This has been more than a generation in coming, and it's a very modest step. We estimate there, from health department numbers, there are at least 225,000 Minnesotans who live in these communities with elevated nitrogen level. And if we as a state can't take some modest, tepid steps to move forward to protect that nearly 250,000 Minnesotans, I think there is something in our water because we're not acting in good faith, so or good sense. So, Mr. Chairman, I know I would be short, so let me just stop there, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Morris.
Oh, the other thing I just wanted to mention is a map of a Duisma for, I think this one is Park Rapids. And what's interesting is it can show the vulnerability areas. These orange areas are the highly vulnerable areas where we would say we really need protection from continuous living cover on the land. We need measures that are going to protect the water. The area right by the city is a lower area, but this whole thing constitutes what's called the Duisma or the wellhead protection area, just so you can see it visually.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Pete Fish. And these last two are going to testify on the bills that we had up today, but again, we aren't going to get to them this morning. We will be coming back this afternoon after session to finish up the last three bills. Go ahead, sir. Sirs, good morning.
Good morning, Chairman Anderson, members of the board. excuse me. My name is Michael Pettifish. I'm a third-generation corn and soybean farmer from southeast Minnesota. I currently am the president of the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association and represent 25,000 Minnesota soybean farmers. I'm here because we are very concerned about this proposed rule and the direction that it's heading from the administration. I do appreciate all the listening sessions the department has had and their attempt to reach out and hear us. However, we feel that a number of our concerns have not been met or have not been heard. I'm specifically referencing the published text of that was released last year by the Department of Ag, and fundamentally we feel this is a solution looking for a problem, as we have not seen any cases of these things since 1980, as according to the Minnesota Department of Health. We believe that the map for exemptions is arbitrary and does not it unnecessarily restricts fall nitrogen, and it does not account for current farming practices. We don't feel the department has demonstrated the rate at which nitrogen moves through the soil profile. Many of these wells are several hundred feet deep, and if I've employed best management practices today, what's to say that that is actually impacting the aquifer below in the next 3 years when they're taking their regulatory window to look at my farm? So, in fact, we may be getting regulated for farming practices from years past. We also think this has unintended surface water consequences, as you fundamentally shift farming practices from fall application in the forms of ammonia, which make a strong bond with soil and are relatively stable. You may actually encourage more plant readily available forms of nitrogen, such as nitrate, which are more leachable in the soil if farmers get pushed into a tighter operating window in the spring, because they're now trying to do more operations prior to planting. For those reasons and others, we essentially support HF 2887 because we feel that this needs legislative oversight, and that some of these rules are being made or decisions being made while we're being in the field and very busy. So we would like to see legislative oversight on those. So thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir.
Just quickly, Chair, members, I'm Joe Smentek. I'm the Director of Public Affairs for Minnesota Soybean. And again, our organization does support Representative Backer's Bill 2887. The Groundwater Protection Act has been cited a few times here this morning. And in that, you know, the Department of Agriculture has some specific authorities over agricultural chemicals and waters where they're polluted by that. The current text does no looking at why these groundwaters are polluted, so we think that there is an excess of the authority there. And as you mentioned on the MAP and DAP issues, we're concerned about the change in definition from the legislature's definition of what a fertilizer is to what they have in their rule, and we think bringing this back before you guys to let you guys have a voice in this process as well is important. Thank you. We'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions, comments? It is lunchtime, but so thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Just a couple of announcements. We will be coming back after session. Don't know how long session's going to go, probably 15 minutes after session. Watch for an email, or we'll announce at the end of session today. So put your information back into your save folder, and we'll have it back tonight.
In this room?
I'm sorry, we'll be in 120 of the Capitol. Capitol 120. So we'll watch the emails, and we'll announce when that'll be. And GOP members, we'll have a huddle upstairs in 454. Right after session. So with that, members, the meeting
right
is
after
in
committee. Right after committee.
After committee, yes. Meeting is recessed. And Representative Green, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My bill is simple. I think we heard in testimony. Excuse me, I'm starting to get a bug here. So I think we heard in testimony this morning regarding the proposed rule that the Department of Ag is bringing forward. And if you read the rule actually is not based on science. It's based on what they believe that the soil conditions are, the types of soil. And I've got some information. It's not going to be as good now because I was going to have it on the screen. But the MPCA had put out a study a couple years ago. I'll find it here. It was called The Water Quality Trends for Minnesota Rivers and Streams at Milestone Sites. And what it shows on there, and you do have a copy of the chart in your packet.
I think we all have a copy of it, yes.
Yep. And it's a little tough to see in black and white, but if you look at, if we just take the phosphorus and nitrogen, you'll see that over the long period of 30 years on the study, that it would have shown an increase, but on the shorter term, on the 15 years, if you go to the right side of your chart, it shows that it shows no trend or decrease. And in the front part of that study, which you may have in your packet as well, if you look under analysis and you read that, it will tell you that basically, if you because of the way the study is done in kind of a monolithic style, that to get to no trend, you actually have to be increasing in those last 15 years. Further down in that study, which I would have had on the screen, shows you where those milestone sites are and where there is still a problem and where there's not, where the nitrogen and phosphorus have been decreasing. And where you would have seen in that chart that the spots that are still a problem are getting closer to the metro area and a few spots in southern Minnesota along the river. And the point is that there's just not a lot of study being done before they're putting this rule forward. And so that's what 2727 is about. After we hear 2727 and you decide what you're going to do with it later on today, I am going to have another bill that will require some testing of state lands and non-touched lands to see where the nitrogen is coming from. And the reason for that is I'm getting information back from some of the people in the valley that when they're doing their own tests, they're finding more nitrogen and phosphate coming off of the state lands than they are the farmlands. And it might sound odd at first, but when you consider the fact that the farmers are actually extracting that nitrogen out as their crop grows, if they don't put that nitrogen back on, they don't get a crop. And nitrogen is produced naturally. And so if it's not being used up, we're getting more runoff from that. And that's what I want to find out. So that's basically the bill and why it's here.
Thank you, Representative Green. Questions on the bill? Representative Johnson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Green, in the Pineland Sands area, which you represent, where there's been increased activity in farming over the last years, a lot of trees have been taken out and replaced with farming. Have you talked to any of the people who live near those farms who have been monitoring their own wells and have experienced an increase in nitrates that happened during that time frame?
I have, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I have talked to some people there, and I've also got the charts of last year. I was getting them on a monthly basis that came from the MPCA that showed that the levels out of the sites that the MPCA was testing, there was maybe one that was over 0.5, I believe, and the rest were all under the guidelines. And so there again, some of the stuff that's been being done up in the Pine Sands aquifer area, just so people are clear on this, the lands that belong to Potlatch that they harvested the timber off of, they were croplands, they were just trees. And the farmers that are up there did not buy that land to increase their crop. They bought that land to increase their rotation. And so to have less impact on the land and to put crops back in that would rejuvenate the land. And so right now, I haven't had anything lately that shows me that there's been a huge increase there.
Follow up, Representative Johnson.
Well, yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just make a comment. As you know, I have a small tree farm up there, and people there tell me what I explain. And I know it's anecdotal and it's not scientific, but I believe them. And, for instance, the gentleman who does some work with us, and it's new farming is where he's experiencing. I'm not so sure it's to expand the rotation. It's more they shifted from trees, long time tree farming to potatoes in a rotation. He lives about half a mile from where that happened, and he watched his well degrade, and he asked me about it because he was concerned because it got to the point it was over 10, so his grandkids couldn't drink that water. And I'm just surprised that you're – and I hear about – there's a lot of talk up there about this, and I'm surprised that you're not hearing that from the people who live around there. And these aren't necessarily farmers. As you know, there's a lot of people who live in the countryside up there that don't necessarily farm. But I think the concern up there is a lot greater than you're hearing, and I'm just surprised at that. Thank you.
Representative Green?
I guess that was a comment more than a question, but, you know, if I were hearing great concern, I would certainly tell you. And there again, one of the things that I would like to do is before we're passing any rules that we get the facts. And I think that's understandable. You know, before we start putting more rules that were made by agencies, which most people know I already have a problem with, if something needs to be done, it should move through this body of elected officials, whether I agree with it or not, whatever the outcome is, at least it's done by elected officials and not unelected people. And so I appreciate the work that the agencies do, but I do have a problem with them making rules when we're not in session, and that's what's going to happen with this rule. It's going to go into effect before we come back into session, if it goes forward.
Additional comments, questions? Anybody in the audience who would care? And again, to explain, the first bill this morning took additional time than we had expected, and we did have at least one testifier on this bill, Steve Morris, and he did testify this morning at the end of the session and expressed his concerns about this piece of legislation, and also talked with the Ag Department, and they would like to have discussed or talked about some of the testimony that came on at the end of the meeting, or toward the end of the meeting, to discuss and give their take on it. And I don't know if they're back here, Ms. Stokes, they're not here, but I offered to have them come back and discuss what they heard this morning as well, because they didn't speak after all the testifiers had a chance to speak. So the invitation is still open for them, but they are not here this afternoon. So if no other testimony or witnesses come forward, any final comments, Representative Green?
No, I think the bill speaks for itself. Most of my bills are pretty simple bills. They're straightforward, not a lot of words. So it's before you and before this committee.
Thank you, Representative. And with that, House File I'm sorry, Representative Bly.
I'd ask for a roll call.
Okay, roll call has been requested. The bill is going to be laid over.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Okay, yeah, okay. Yeah, we're not going to move this bill on. The bill is being laid over. House File 2727 is being laid over.
Thank you.
And next, do you want to take care of your other bill, or should we
I'm more than willing to do it now. If
you want to rest your voice,
that's up to you, Mr. Chair.
Well, let's go with Representative Backer's bill, and you can rest your voice for a second. Next up is Representative Backer's bill, Vice Chair Backer's bill, House File 2887. The topic is on a similar vein, somewhat different to the take on the bill. Would you care to move your bill, Vice Chair Backer?
I would care to move the bill, and I understand this would go to GovOps.
Yep, that is correct.
And there's no amendments.
Okay. Okay. Testimony on your bill, Representative Backer?
Okay. My bill, really what it does is, on these type of rules or guidance, this really needs to be vented through the whole process. It needs to be ratified by the House and the Senate. Just some of the things I wanted to point out here. MDA wants to use its own court to enforce this law. We need to talk about this further. The administrative court strips away many of the rights that local district courts offer. For instance, there's no jury. The administrative judge does not look at all the evidence and related circumstances. He mostly or she looks at procedural. This would limit the appeal process that is shared in this current guidance from MDA. I'll give an example. In one of my communities, MPCA wanted to do a similar thing. The local attorney refused to do it, and it went to district court. The local judge recognized the value of using a house burning by the local fire department. So it wasn't just an administration moving around. It looked at all circumstances. And if a landowner wants to appeal the process, it should look at district court. Again, that's why we need to vent this through both the House and the Senate. Number two, MDA is violating 103A-403 because over 25 years ago, the EQB board was supposed to be compiling all this data from all pollution sources into one database. Now, MDA has gone off its own looking at all, now MDA has gone off on its own looking at only fertilizers pollution and making law based on incomplete data. EQB has not even fulfilled the statute by doing its own legal appointed job. Again, we need to look at this further. Number two, Minnesota is the land of 10,000 lakes, and this surface water recharges the groundwater. We didn't even test lakes for the source of nitrogen since July 25th of 2013. This is not following scientific methods, as I learned as a chemistry major. Number three, all the geese and waterfowl that migrate rest and nest in Minnesota, and they poop in the lake and in the surrounding fields. The poop contains a lot of nitrates. If we allow septic tanks or our feedlots to drain directly into a lake or river, we would be up in arms. Yet MDA does not even mention the semi-migration of our pooping waterfowl contaminating our lakes and fields. All of this, or any wildlife. So again, we have to look at how that affects our nitrates. Also, I have found we only monitor 15 of our largest municipal sewer treatment facilities and not look at if there's nitrates coming from there. Number five, a cost-benefit study of regulating farm sector for nitrates must be done to see how it affects things. You know, if any federal funding has been accepted by MDA or agencies associated with this rule, then federal law requires that an environmental impact statement be done to assess the impacts to both human and natural systems. And finally, the common carp is ruining our lakes and polluting our water streams. These pigs of the water roots up our native plants and makes the water dirty and unfit for our species. But we've not looked at how fish and other things could affect the nutrient cycle of our lakes, which eventually can impact our groundwater. So what I'm trying to say is if you agree or disagree with me, there's so many things that we need to look at, and that's why it's important that we go through the whole venting process and have it ratified by the House and the Senate. That's all. Chair and members.
Representative Poppy had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do I need to turn this on or something? No. Am I good? Okay.
Maybe you can pull it a little closer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There we go. All right. Just a couple of comments, maybe on the last bill and this one. You know, I have the really good fortune of having a notable and well-respected cousin by the name of Dr. Giles Randall. And Giles is probably a familiar name to many people who are involved in agriculture. And I have talked to Giles just this week about this particular issue. And believe me, he has opinions about what has been going on since 1989, because he's been involved with this, much like Steve Morris was involved with it, just like Commissioner Fredrickson was involved with it. Dr. Giles Randall has been involved with this when it comes to nitrogen, when it comes to all sorts of things, what the soil, the vulnerable soils, what the mapping looks like, what's been done. He's been active and involved and been scientifically researching this. So some of this that comes up to say that we don't have good science is just not right. We do have science. We have there has been a lot of samples taken, thousands of samples taken over the course of many years. There's been a lot of discussion. I really appreciated what Representative Bly said today about us getting into the culture wars. I think we are all here. We want good air, good soil, good land, good. We want, and we've talked about this before, the legacy for ourselves, for our children, is that we want to make sure that the land we leave is in better shape than the land we receive, because that's our legacy. That's what we want to continue to do. And believe me, Dr. Randall and I had the conversation about how this has become much more of a political animal than it ever used to be. We used to be all on the same board talking about water quality and taking care of the earth and understanding and being respectful of each other's opinions and being able to kind of maneuver through things. And it's disheartening to hear that we are not necessarily doing that as respectfully as maybe was done 30 years ago. So on this particular bill, I can appreciate that, you know, we maybe think that we know a lot because we're legislators. But frankly, there are a lot of people in the communities that we serve who know a heck of a lot more than we do about a heck of a lot more things. I mean, we may be experts on certain things. We may understand the political process and how it works, and we're able to do that. But I am not a scientist. Representative Backer indicates he's a chemist. I'm not. I'm a social scientist, if we were going to go down that road. I have a sociology background and a counseling background. But I think that we just need to be thinking about that we do have good science. This work has been done. It's been done for a lot of years. And when it comes to water quality, we need to think about our children, our grandchildren, the people who should be able to, and as I can quote Giles, it should be a human right to be able to drink water out of a well without having to treat it. And that's something that I think we kind of forget about, that we used to have clear running water. We used to be able to do that. And now that we don't have that anymore, something is causing that problem. And something may be that it's part of what has happened on agricultural land and what we've been doing. Maybe there are other things. Maybe it's naturally occurring to some degree. But there has been science done to indicate that there are some farming practices that maybe we should be changing or looking at, trying to do things with. And I appreciate that the department has tried to tiptoe through this. I think that's been a huge challenge. But this isn't something that just came up 6 weeks ago. This has been something that's been going on seriously since 1989. And certainly in the last number of years, it's been something that we've all taken more interest in, because we have heard stories about water quality and how that's impacting people's quality of life. So I just needed to be able to say that. I'm not sure what we're voting on, if we're voting on this bill or not, but I really just caution us to really think long term. You know, we hold this position. And I hold this position in high regard. I am unbelievably honored to be able to serve in the Minnesota House of Representatives. It is something that I'm proud of it. I know my kids are proud of me. I know that, you know, my family is proud of me. And when that taking that and moving that forward is, to me, what is my legacy here? And I think that I just ask all of you to think about that and to think about not doing something that could continue to be harmful if we have the possibility of making a difference and making it better for the people that we leave behind. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Representative Poppe. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a brief comment, Representative Poppe, I actually agree with pretty much everything that you said about what our goals are here, and that we should work together, that we want drinking water and stuff like that. But what we're here to discuss about with this bill is about rulemaking and the role of it. And with all due respect, I believe that there are probably plenty of people smarter than me in this room, in the labs, in the agencies. I don't deny that. But if we base things off of who is the smartest in the room to make the decisions, then we wouldn't need a representative government. And what this bill addresses is that we are duly appointed people elected by the people of our district to step up and say, hey, we want to be represented. You are our tool to make sure that our voice be heard, no matter how articulate and inarticulate it is. And I think all that Representative Backer is trying to do in this bill is saying that this rulemaking, first of all, is a trend that we see, so there's some worry about it, but specific to this, we're just saying that when there's rulemaking, we need to be able to address it as the elected representatives of people in our district, and I think that's what we need to keep a focus on, and that's why I think this bill needs to be supported.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. From my understanding, this is something the legislature has kind of already asked for with the Groundwater Act and with the following plan that they asked for. But I was reading one of the quotes that was in one of the handouts that we got, and it clearly states, groundwater be maintained in its natural condition, free from any degradation caused by human activities. And you listed a number of natural activities as things that we should be considering or looking at. Are you saying that you think that human activity has not caused any of the nitrates that are in the water?
Representative Backer?
What I was saying here is that we need to look at those, because when you do a study and you're looking for nitrates, you don't say, well, okay, that nitrate comes from a human activity, that nitrate comes from geese. So we just want to look at everything, and that's one of the, like Representative Miller has said, we have to look at everything in ratification of something this significant and not just rulemaking. You know, what's happening in rulemaking like this thing, we are here to set policy. Agencies are not the fourth branch of government. And in this situation here, that concerns me. And also it concerns me that, yes, that talks about possibly just human, but we can't do a chemistry test or a lab test saying, where did this nitrate come? I think it needs to be incorporated. I had a constituent in my office yesterday talking about two lakes between Alexandria and Chairs Anderson's district in Glenwood. He was talking about the amount of geese that are in there and so forth. So that's what I'm sharing.
Farwell, Representative Bly.
So, I think, this was enacted, the Ground Protection, Water Protection Act in 1989, and there's been a lot of work done, a lot of talk done about how to make sure that we have clean water. And, in many cases, what I hear back is, it's not us. Agriculture says it's not us. Don't look at us. And I think it's important that we also consider the effects that have happened over time with agriculture. And, in my looking at the history here, I think agriculture has changed significantly, even since 1989. And if you go back further in the 70s or even the 40s, it's changed considerably. And, I think it's fairly clear with nitrates that, and the addition of having to add fertilizer, that corn is perhaps the crop that, needs that kind of fertilization the most. And we are growing a lot more corn than we have in the past. And, even if you look at it economically, the amount of corn that we grow causes prices to drop. And we keep looking for more and more ways to use that corn that we're growing. And it would seem to me that not only would it serve our purposes to look at the problems we have with nitrates, but to help farmers look at other ways, other crops that they might grow, to look at the use of cover crops. And I think, all of this information is helping us figure out that there are other things we can do that we really want to be able to direct farmers in a different direction. And if we continually say, oh, it's not us, we're not the problem, we'll never get to that. We'll never get farmers to be thinking about how can we change what we do? How can we change our economic structure so that farming can grow in a different way? I guess I'm hopeful that if we look at what's happening in nature, if we look at what's happening with the nitrates in the groundwater and take caution to make sure that we're protecting that water. And I can't see that it's not related to agriculture in some ways, looking at how agriculture has changed. You know, this past summer I was at a national conference where a fellow from Ohio talked about his efforts to do a very same thing that the rule does, to limit fall spreading of manure and nitrogen in the fall. And what he was citing is, look at Lake Erie. Look what's happened to it. And all of the pollutants that have gone into Lake Erie. You think about it, years ago, there used to be a natural filter that caught a lot of pollution that might have gone through. It's all been developed. There's no filter anymore. And unless you look at ways to try to prevent some of that from happening, you know, it's very evident in Lake Erie. It's maybe not so evident unless we test the waters here in Minnesota, in the wellheads. We need to look at that. We need to make sure that we are working together to keep our water clean. I'm concerned about your bill that opens things up to the political conversation rather than the true science of what's happening. And that concerns me. Thank you.
Representative Backer.
One of the things, and I appreciate those comments, I've talked to several ag producers. They share me a simple statement. If you're over nitrating or putting fertilizer on your ground, you're out of business because you're wasting a lot of resources. So the economics also allows them, not even just science or and I'm not talking from the political. I have a farmer in Hancock that's south of Hancock, very sandy soil, and he goes, if I'm putting soil, nitrates on the soil and over, I'm not going to be in business. So that's all I have is there's economics also behind it. And that's also acting as a check and balance, too.
Anybody in the audience care to comment or testify on the bill? Representative Bly.
Thank you again. I just remember in ag finance, we heard a livestock farmer talk about how he was utilizing cover crops and some other remedies to help his use of nitrogen and use of fertilizer. And I think you're right. If you're overusing it, you are wasting funds. But not everybody, I think, thinks that way. And, you know, when we focus almost totally, it seems to me, again, I'm not a farmer and I don't necessarily know all about this, but when we focus just on yield, we maybe are thinking, let's apply more nitrogen, let's apply more fertilizer so we can increase our yield. What he said was, I focus on soil health. And I don't see any reduction in my yield. And again, I think there are practices, there are ways that agriculture is done today that it could be improved upon, and we could avoid this very problem. And those farmers could probably benefit from looking at different crops and different things that would enhance their portfolio. Thank you.
I'm listening, I'm enjoying the conversation, and I'll have a couple things to say when we finish. Miss, please go on up there. You know, the talk about other crops and such, farmers have to remain in business. The sustainability part, a lot of that is profitability. And if there were other crops that were profitable, although corn isn't so profitable right now either, but we have to be able to sustain ourselves out there on the farm and make a living. And just a comment on the yield. Yes, the yields have gone up, but the actual use of nitrogen per bushel of yield has actually gone down. It used to be a pound of nitrogen for a bushel of corn yield. Today, that's getting down to between 0.6 and 0.7 pounds of N per bushel of yield. So the efficiency has increased. And as far as the number of acres being devoted to corn, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but we had a lot more acres being farmed back in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And because of increased technology and better practices, the yields have increased. but the number of acres under cultivation, I would say, has not increased in the past 20 years. It's, in fact, probably decreased because of the increased technology that's used to increase the yields to get those crops that we have. My pedestal is tipped over. Ms. Place, your turn to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Whitney Place. I'm the Director of Legislative Affairs at the Department of Agriculture. The Department of Agriculture opposes House File 2887 that would strip the agency's ability to promulgate environmental protection rules under the Groundwater Protection Act. As Commissioner Fredrickson testified earlier today, the department is charged with a unique but appropriate mission of enhancing our farm economy and protecting the health of our environment. House File 2887 and House File 2727 heard earlier impede that mission, and the department opposes both bills. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Questions from members? I would just ask Ms. Place, if there are no other questions, just being frank here, I think one of the concerns that a lot of us had when the press release came out in the timeline was that you'd get the rule published middle or the end of May, about the time we left session, and then you would finalize the rule in December, right before we came back. And I think that caused some angst. And could you give us some comfort language that you'll work with us and get the rule to us before we leave session and have a chance to interact with you and offer comments? That's what I would be asking.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, I think Commissioner Fredrickson actually said earlier today that our goal is to get it published by early May. Additionally, if you take a look at the timeline that was distributed earlier this morning, the fall fertilizer application prohibition wouldn't actually go into effect until January of 2020. So there will be legislative sessions, even if the rule does, move forward, there will be legislative sessions to address any concerns that the legislative body has.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney, did you? Oh, okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know where to go with this, but I'm this is my last year, and I'm proud of what I too am proud of serving, and I'm probably most proud of my work in these committees. I love agriculture, and it's been exciting to represent the farmers in my district, but the farmers across Minnesota. I agree with you. I think high yields are great, and I'm glad that the farmers in my district are able, when the price is right, that they can make a buck on growing corn and beans in it. And I see a lot of prosperous families, a stable economy. It's fundamentally central to where I live. I also think that when I listen, I learn a lot. The way I learn about farming, I talk to a lot of farmers. And on this issue particularly, I find it interesting that the reaction you're getting is so different than mine. Again, I repeat, at the town hall, I had, the farmer who farms in the wellhead protection area for the city of St. Peter, which has a reverse osmosis system, which everybody in town pays every month a lot more money for their water. St. Peter's not the wealthiest town in the state. And they kind of all know what's going on, but it's just generally recognized that there's an issue with that coarse soil. It's kind of we have heavy soil in Neckwick County, except where the wellhead is taken. And it creates a problem. And one of the gentlemen who farms in that area, when this came up, the rule came up in the town hall, just said, of course I know I'm farming differently on the coarse soils. And then that comment was repeated again when the corn growers were in my office earlier this week, had a wonderful conversation with a couple of farmers I've learned to know well. I just know they're good farmers. Basically the same thing. Of course I farm. One farmer talked about I have coarse soil on part of my farm, and of course I would never put nitrogen on in the fall. And it's just, I think we've got fantastic farmers in this state. I see it all. Just drive through Neckwick County in August, and I'll show you fantastic farmers, one after another. In fact, you can do it across the state. And I think those farmers are doing a good job on the farm. They understand the impact of nitrates on the drinking water, and they're trying to adjust to it. Representative Green talked about the crop rotation up in the Pineland Sands, and I agree. I've seen that. I spent a fair amount of time up there. And I'll tell you, I do see it, and I've seen a significant change in the last several years. I see a much broader rotation than there was 5 or 10 years ago.
And this is an issue, again, up in that area. Trust me, it's talked about. And people, it's a topic of conversation. People are watching. But what I've observed is farmers are changing. And I'll tell you, that's where I see cover crops. The farmers up there have adopted cover crops. I don't think they're making a lot of money on those cover crops. But I think those farmers are good farmers, and I think they're adapting to the situation by putting cover crops on that landscape, because they know, they've heard from their neighbors, maybe their own wells, they're worried about their wells. And so they're trying to adjust. And in many ways, that's what this rule is about, to help make sure that all farmers are doing best practices to reduce nitrates in water. What this bill does really is an assault on rulemaking in general. And I sit on the Environment and Natural Resources Committee, and we go back and forth on permits and rulemaking all the time. But really, the purpose of rulemaking, I think, is to bring this stuff away from politics. And the way we do rulemaking, because we know that the listening sessions were held, we heard about that earlier, I have no doubt that Commissioner Fredrickson is going to make darn sure there are effective public comments this summer. I hope nobody in this room doubts that, because that would be really impugning his integrity. A man who has served for decades in this state to promote good agriculture and promote productive and profitable farming in Minnesota. And he will do that. I have no doubt about that. I did mention to a couple of farmers this week that since I am retiring, I don't think I'll be quite so busy. I'm also going to be watching it this summer. And I fully intend to watch this very closely while I'm still a member throughout the year, and that's part of it. But the idea, and I'm confident that they will listen, and I'm confident that the people will have an opportunity to provide input into this rule. That's the way we do this sort of scientific rulemaking. But I also really hear, and I hear this all the time, I think you hear it when you go door to door, I think the public's sick of politics. I think that we are in this. I had a neat conversation today with some folks. These are actually some, we had our co-op, electric co-op was in town today. And we talked about how this is inherently a partisan body and a partisan institution. We have partisan, it's just the way we're organized. These folks understood that completely. And sometimes we talk about trying to keep politics out of things, and it's hard to do in this building. It just is. It's the nature of what we do. And again, that's why we do rulemaking. And I would suggest that the public is sick of politics being in every part of our civic discussions. I would think especially when it comes to your drinking water. This is what the water we drink. And the issue with nitrates is really the water our youngest children drink. I say, let's let this go forward. Let's not do these bills. I think the statements have made, you have the opportunity to make these statements, but I would encourage not to advance this bill, not to advance the last bill. Let's put some good faith and trust in the Department of Agriculture, led by people who day in and day out demonstrate their commitment to agriculture, and let's make sure that we're protecting the drinking water of Minnesotans. And you know what? If we do this well, and if agriculture gets engaged in it, agriculture comes out ahead. Because I tell you, if agriculture gets blamed for bad drinking water in this state, I don't see how we come ahead. I don't see how agriculture comes out ahead. So I really hope you withdraw this motion. I would ask you to withdraw the bill, and let's just step back. Let the process, let's be adults, let's do it the right way, and make sure it works well to protect high productive, good, profitable agriculture, but also to protect the drinking water that families in this state depend on.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank Representative Backer for bringing this bill forward, and I'm sorry, Representative Johnson, but I disagree with you a little bit. I understand the politics part, and I don't like when politics gets into things either. But I look at this more as bringing the people's voice forward, because that's my job and all of our jobs here sitting at this table who are elected officials. We are representing the voices of the people of our area. And right now, I know what I hear from my people is they don't feel like they're being listened to by our agencies or by our government. They're feeling railroaded and ramrodded through things. We heard some of that this morning, the frustrations, and it's farmers and it's businesses and all those areas. And those voices are the ones that are the most important. They're the people who are doing the work. So I know our farmers, we all want clean water. That's our goal. And I think the farmers are just asking here is, let's not just blame farmers for this. We need to look at everything. And I don't mind a little bit of a pause here, like Representative Backer is asking, bringing this back to this body so that we can examine it and, again, hear those voices from people and then go forward with the things, you know, that make sense, that are going to make our water clean, but that will also respect the people who are putting food on our tables. So I do agree with this bill. And Representative Backer, I do have a question for you. Is what are you hearing on the frustrations from farmers and so on just basically not being listened to? Because they're the ones that really, they understand land a lot. And obviously in the past, I think things have been just from lack of knowledge, maybe abused some, but I really see when the farmers I talk to and watch that they're doing good things for our water. And do you hear the frustrations that I hear? Because I hear a lot of those frustrations.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, Chair Anderson, Representative Bennett. Yes, I'm hearing the frustration. It's a common sense. If you put too much nitrogen into the soil, you're going to be out of business. It's being micromanaged. As we know, farm economy is difficult. I am not a farmer, but I am a business owner. And one of the challenges that we see is state agencies stepping out of their bounds. And, yes, I believe in this situation, MDA has stepped out of their bounds and so forth. And that's why we need the proper vetting. You said it the best way. We are here, and Representative Miller, we're here to represent the people. When I go to my town halls, respectfully, I hear the opposite. They feel like they are not the political process, but the farmers and feel like they're the bad guys out there. They're trying to do good. The rural area feeds the metro, and that's what they want to continue to do. And they are the best stewards of our land. And I'm concerned that this rulemaking says, hey, we know better in St. Paul than what the people who own the land. So thank you for asking.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. and thank you, Representative Backer, for bringing this forward. And I actually do want to agree with Representative Johnson on a few things from what I'm hearing in my district, that there are a lot of farmers already who are not applying nitrogen in the fall. They're doing the right thing, and it's not necessarily because of their concerns of leaching nitrates, but it's because of the economics. It's because fall-applied nitrogen is at risk of leaching in the spring if we have a wet spring. So they're using new equipment. I farmed with my in-laws for 2 years. I wanted to get into farming, and I realized the economics are so important. And this is why I helped them switch to spring-applied, you know, nitrogen for the most part, side-dressing corn. So actually you're not even spreading fertilizer over the entire swath of your field, but you're just putting it down a narrow strip of 10 inches down the row so that you can use the very least amount of nitrogen possible in order to maintain almost a full yield. And it increases the economics. And this is what our young farmers and the next generation have to do to survive. They're buying land at retail prices now, and they have to make the economics work, which means using the least amount of inputs is, you know, necessary to grow corn. This problem, this issue with the high cost of nitrogen and inputs has changed over the past 10 years. And this is having a slow impact on the amount of nitrates that are out there. And so I agree that we need to delay this rule so that we can actually look at the numbers over the next few years to see how they've changed. Farmers also need consistency, and they need to, you know, be able to forecast out for more than just, you know, a year for their costs. They need to control their inputs and understand where they're going to be. They're making decisions right now in the land that they're buying that are impacting their, you know, their farms over the next several years. They need to know that they can run their business, that they have a right to farm and not be impacted by rules, where most of them are going to be doing the right thing, but they need to know they have options on how they can farm. And they are, you know, they understand also that they need to be good stewards of their land, that they're responsible for the water quality in their area. And they can't just pack up and leave because their land is there, their farms are there, they're part of the community, and they understand that they have an important role, and they will do the right thing. But I'm here as a representative of my district to say that this is not the role of government to be over-regulating these industries. Let the farmers farm, and they will make the right decision. And I think we need to look further into the data, and so I'm supportive of this rule, of this bill. Thank you.
Let's place one question. When the press conference was held last week and you released the statewide map, and folks immediately try to drill in to find their little piece of heaven, their township or section. When will that map be ready to go online so folks can drill in to see their exact areas?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're hoping that the map is up early next week. We're also working to get, I'm going to get this wrong, but my staff informed me that we're trying to allow farmers to be able to use their co-op maps so that they can identify, you know, which areas fall under the purple or green.
We might be getting in the weeds here, but
yeah.
Co-op maps, you mean like their yield maps or?
Like their soil maps.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Their soil maps.
Okay.
Sorry, I wasn't clear on the terminology.
You did pretty good, though.
Thanks.
again, anybody in the audience who care to comment? Final thoughts on Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make an additional comment. To be very clear, the department hasn't done anything that they shouldn't have done because they have the ability to promulgate this rule. So, I mean, I think that that's been thrown out a little bit, that maybe that they've gone over the top and they're doing something that they shouldn't be doing, that they've gone beyond. And I just to be clear, I mean, that is part of the process. They are they're following the process and they're doing that. So that was one comment. And then the second comment, if you indulge me, Mr. Chair, is just I was impressed with the corn growers today. I mean, when they talked about they've spent over $6 million in their own research and what they're doing, I mean, there is no doubt that farmers are trying to do the best they can do to get the best yields they can get, to be the best farmers, to be the best stewards, to do all of that. They recognize, though, that maybe there are some other things that they could be or should be doing. They're researching on their own. They're seeking information and input. And I just think that, you know, collectively, I think corn growers, Farm Bureau, the soybean, whoever, and everybody who's kind of involved in this, again, I just want us all to think we all live in Minnesota. We all benefit from a good quality of life here. We benefit from what we've done in the past and hopefully what we'll do in the future.
Thank you. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. Just to follow up on that a little bit, I think that the department is following through on a charge that we gave them. And I think we don't necessarily have to look at what they're doing as adversarial. They're trying to develop a message to farmers that there are things you can do. There are policies and other things. The water certification, for instance, process is another way of supporting farmers in doing the right thing. When we talk about rural Minnesota, there are not only farmers that live in rural Minnesota, and there are many people who care about their water, and they want assurances that farmers are doing the right thing. And there are many farmers who do, and I heard the corn growers as well today. And, yes, they are doing good things. But I think this is a way of communicating to the public in general that agriculture is doing the right thing. We're going to move in the right direction. And the Department of Ag, I think, rather than being an adversary, is trying to be a partner here, trying to say let's work together to make sure that we are showing that our water can be clean, we can have agriculture, and we can work together.
With that final comments, I hope, Representative Backer.
I would ask for your support. I think a lot has been shared. I do appreciate the passion on each side. People know where I stand, so I would ask for your support. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Roll call has been requested. Roll call will be taken. On the motion to refer House File 2887 onto the Government Operations Committee, the chairman votes aye.
Backer?
Aye.
Bennett?
Aye.
Bly?
No.
Daniels? Johnson?
No.
Kunesh Podin? Lewick?
Aye.
Mahoney? Mariani? Miller?
Yes.
Munson?
Aye.
Nornes?
Aye.
Pearson?
Aye.
Poppy?
No.
Poston?
Aye.
Sauk?
The The vote count is 9 in favor and 5 against. The motion passes, and the bill is re-referred on to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections.
Thank you, members.
Thanks, Representative Backer. Last bill up tonight, House File 3607. I will move House File 3607 to be referred to the Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources, Policy and Finance. Representative Green, do you have an amendment to your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the amendment. The A1 amendment?
I would move the amendment after we have it explained. Would you explain to us what the amendment does?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The original bill dealt with just nitrogen, and what it is trying to do is, because I have asked agencies if they have any kind of study, any kind of information of the amount of nitrogen and phosphate that comes off of land naturally, just untouched land, what are we getting off of that? And I haven't been able to get an answer. And so I'm under the impression that they don't have that information. And I agree with Representative Poppy that that information should be there. I mean, we've got enough tests, but if they have it, they're not giving it to me. But in looking through the different studies that I have seen as far as nitrogen and phosphate and the fact that it is seems to be decreasing in the spots that have been tested around the state, I decided that if we're going to do the test anyway, it might be just as well or even better to add the phosphorus to it and then to require monthly, when they take their test, to send out the reports of that monthly to the members of the committee so that we will have the results of the test as they come in. So that's what the amendment does.
Okay. The A1 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is passed and the bill is in the correct form. So your bill is amended, Representative Green, 3607.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I probably just explained the bill. I don't know what else there is to say. I do think that it's important to get the study as to what occurs naturally. We hear a lot of talk about nitrogen. I'm not going to go back into the rulemaking authority. I think that has been discussed. But I do think that when the tests that we have and the MPCA's own reports show that nitrogen is being reduced in these 80 milestone spots, that in the places where it has been increased, it looks like they're point source. And I think it's just a good idea to find out what comes off the ground naturally. Are we fighting against something that is occurring? You know, if nitrogen makes up 80% of our air, we're breathing it. Nitrates come from what is expelled. And so it's a naturally occurring substance. We need it for survival. So we should find out what occurs naturally. That's the point of the bill.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author of the bill, are we doing tests on nitrogen and phosphorus in these locations now?
Representative Green?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, that's what I haven't been able to find out. I've been asking for this since last year, to find out what comes naturally, and I haven't been able to get an answer, so I'm assuming that we're not testing these spots.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
So then, Mr. Chair, are we asking with this bill, the department to perform 2 new tests on water? And if so, who's paying for it?
Very good question. And we just talked about that. This is going to be going on to the Environment Finance Committee, and I'm sure that'll be raised at that committee, that point.
Mr. Chair?
To
you and to the committee members, I have asked for a fiscal note. I just haven't received it yet. It's been taking a little longer than I thought. I'm very hopeful that I'll have that fiscal note before we hit the Finance Committee.
I'm sure you'll have to have it. Yeah.
Yep.
Representative Mahoney.
One other question. There's monthly reports submitted to the committee member on your amendment, line 5 and 6. You're asking for monthly reports submitted to committee members. All of us going to get this report every month?
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Mahoney, when the MPCA was doing the studies, and I believe they still are in the watershed districts and in water management areas, I should say, they require that the results come in every month, and I would assume that this would be too, and I was getting them. And so this would give us an indication month to month. And it's not that they would have to send out things. It could be done by email, and that was the idea, that if they're going to be taking them anyway, they have the information, let's have it. That's the point of the monthly.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, and I don't mean this derogatorily, but you earlier referred to the fact that most of your bills are short and light on words. This might have been a case where you might have needed to put a few more words into it.
We've asked Ms. Place to come up from the Department of Ag. Ms. Place, is the department capable of doing this type of testing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, not at this time. We are working on the fiscal note, which I think is due next week. So we're taking a look at what wells exist right now on state land. So we've been working with GIS layers from the DNR. So we're calculating those, determining what wells we would have to install and what kind of testing. Our preliminary numbers say that there would be like a startup cost of around $16 million to install wells in all of these areas, and then ongoing costs would be about $4 million per year with an estimated 25 FTEs to carry it out.
Representative Green?
Mr. Chair, and to your point, Representative Mahoney, if they did every state land, that would be right, but I left it vague for a reason. These things get worked out as they move forward, and we're going to have to pick test spots. And I don't think that legislature should be picking the spots, but I do believe that we have to leave some open ground there and maybe test the spots that we're not getting information from now. And so, no, I realize we're not going to spend $16 million to test every piece of state land, but it was left that way because, like I said, we do go through the process, and I think it'll be worked out as we move forward, or can be worked out as we move forward.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Green, what do you mean, what is meant by outdoor recreation system lands?
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just trying to encompass enough so that there's different, as you know, serving on the Environmental Committee, there's different classifications for land. And so by putting that in there, they can be a part of it if those spots are picked instead of just blanketing it out there. So there's WMAs that we're testing now. There's just tax forfeited lands. There's different classifications of land, and so it was just added in for that purpose.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. So it would be like the Huntersville State Forest, Itasca State Park? That kind of place?
Well, I don't know the exact spots, and that's what I say. That's why it was left vague, so that we could work with the department and we could pick the spots, or they could pick the spots around the state of state land where they thought we needed testing or where the testing would be valuable.
Ms. Place, as long as you're up there, you mentioned the staggering cost of installing wells to satisfy a bill like this. And I was going to ask earlier, On the previous bill about the nitrogen rule, that's going to take some new wells as well, some monitoring wells. How is that going to work out and the cost estimates on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, the rule has not been promulgated, but the wells that we do intend to use for monitoring in the DWSMAs are Department of Health wells, so they're already installed and the department does that monitoring. There may be a cause for additional monitoring systems, but we don't have the budgets for any of that figured out yet.
Okay, thank you. Anybody in the audience who would care to comment on the House file 3607? If not, thanks, Ms. Place. Any final comments, Representative Green?
No, I think it's been discussed. I think we've discussed a lot of different things here, and it's been good conversation. I appreciate it. I'd like to move this forward to the other committees, and we will have the fiscal note and maybe work out some of the other details there. Thank you.
So with that, all in favor of the House File 3607 is amended. Moving on to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion is passed, and the bill is on its way. Thanks, Representative Green.
Thank you.
With that, members, thank you for your patience. It's been a long day today. The meeting is adjourned.